The drum beat against me as someone who wants Obama to fail personally. I hope, especially with what we've seen now, I hope he fails in implementing all this. To me, this is a no-brainer. We want something to blow up here. This is not just mortgaging the future. This is a full-fledged attack on capitalism. This is a reordering and a transformation of the basic free market. We're talking about freedom that is under assault.
This Week in Radical History for the week of March 2nd. Inspiration for this piece came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for March 2nd, 1877. Despite an apparent Democratic victory at the polls, the Electoral College, swayed by Republican bribery, selects Rufford B. Hayes, a Republican, as president. Supporters of Democratic Tilghman rightfully claim a stolen election. Real Bush League stuff. Also on March 2nd, 1899, Congress allows railroad companies blanket approval of right-of-way through all Native American lands. Without compensation, of course. Also on March 2nd, 1917, in Puerto Rico, U.S. President Wilson thwarts Puerto Rican independence, takes over the island, and controls its economy and fiscal aspects of the government. Wilson also signs a compulsory military service act into law, and 20,000 islanders are drafted into World War I. Welcome to America. In 1930, Gandhi begins his 200-mile march to protest the salt tax. Also on this day in radical history for 1942, acting under Executive Order 9066, General DeWitt proclaims all Japanese Americans will be required to move away from the West Coast and recommends for, quote, their own good, unquote, they should do so voluntarily. Only a small portion do so, so later this month they will make it mandatory. Also on this date, 1982, Philip K. Dick dies, American science fiction dystopia writer. He once said, "The basic tool of all manipulation of reality is the manipulation of words. If you can control the meaning of words, you can control the people who must use the words."
From where Winston stood, it was possible to read, picked out on his white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party: war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, March 3rd in 1863, Congress passed the first draft law in United States history, authorizing the president to draft citizens into the Civil War. While most of the North supported the Union, the shortage of men enlisting in the military, especially in New York City, is what sparked this law. One of the provisions of the draft law allowed a man to exempt himself from being drafted in exchange for $300. This was controversial because $300 in 1863 was a sum of money that only rich people could afford, and the war quickly became known among the middle and lower classes as the rich man's war and the poor man's fight. Soon after this legislation passed, rioting spread angrily through New York City in a violent expression of displeasure with the law. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, say it, the past, slip away.
Also on March 3rd, 1871, the Senate decides it will no longer contract treaties with Native American nations. Congress calls all Native Americans wards of the state and nullifies all standing treaties. Also on March 3, 1873, Comstock Act makes it illegal to send obscene or lewd books or birth control information through the U.S. mail. Also on this date in 1919, a ruling on the conviction of anarchists Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, the Supreme Court upholds the Espionage Act. Goldman and Berkman were arrested during World War I for a so-called conspiracy against the draft. Today's court ruling thus puts draft resistance outside First Amendment protection. Emma Goldman's last act before entering prison is to organize a political prisoners' amnesty league. During the war, thousands of deserters have been sentenced to long prison terms. At Eagle Island, a concentration camp for deserters, many of them were systematically tortured. At the federal prison in Leavenworth, Kansas, prisoners have been hung by their wrists for up to weeks at a time. Take that, you peace-loving Quakers. Also on March 3rd, 1961, village council in Inuit town of Point Hope in a far northwestern Alaska, objects by letter to President John F. Kennedy to a chain explosion of 5 atomic bombs in nearby above-ground Project Chariot test, to no avail. Also on this date in 1983, Acting President Ronald Reagan calls for a week of reporting only good news. Also on this date in 1989, Rodney King is savagely beaten by L.A. cops on this date, and it is all videotaped. Despite the video evidence, a nearly all-white jury will not convict the cops.
Seems so definitive. Why did the jury see the beating of Rodney King in such a vastly different light? Here's ABC's Judy Muller.
It was never even close. On the very first day of deliberations, a straw vote made it clear that a majority of the jurors favored acquittal. How could that be, given the powerful evidence of the videotape? Two jurors talked to ABC News today by phone.
These officers have a job to do, and in doing that job, they have to be given a certain amount of reasonable, and that's what this is, you know, reasonable force.
Several jurors say they were persuaded by the defense argument that the videotape did not tell the whole story and that Rodney King represented a threat to the officers. The jurors were convinced that it was King who controlled the action, that he could have stopped the beating by surrendering. The officers, they felt, used reasonable force.
The jury was made up of 10 whites, one Hispanic, and one Asian. Critics of the verdict are questioning whether this jury of their peers gave the white defendants an edge and whether King's race was a factor.
What human being wouldn't be influenced by this? You know, this is ridiculous. This is chaos right now, and I can't help but feel somewhat responsible.
And yet, he says, if he had to do it again, he would vote the same way.
And justice for all. This week in radical history, for March 4th, 1912, in England, suffragettes walk in single file in King Bridge, London, smashing every window they pass to protest government inaction. This week in radical history, for March 5th, 1917, Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, also known as IWW, go on trial in Everett, Washington. The labor agitators were gunned down by a government-sanctioned mob, sheriff-led vigilantes. Like most cases of labor strife, the government, big business, police, military, and media are aligned against the unionists. Also on March 5th, 1983, can't see the forest from the trees. Acting President Ronald Reagan visits Klamath County, Oregon. Reagan says, quote,
"Well, there is today in the U.S. as much forest as there was when Washington was at Valley Forge."
A lie, of course. Actually, there is less than one-third. This week in radical history, from March 6, 1930, 100,000 demonstrate for jobs in New York City. Demonstrations by unemployed workers demanding unemployment insurance occur in a variety of major cities throughout the country. Police attack a crowd of 35,000 in New York City, and 10,000 people engage in melee with police in Cleveland. Why 35,000 jobless workers march down Woodward in national protest against unemployment and hunger. Thousands join together and walk to the Ford Motor Company's employment office in Dearborn. Henry Ford, whose plant had laid off more than one-third of its employees, declared that, quote, "who wanted a job could find one," unquote. The marchers attend to take old Henry up on a statement. Violence erupts between the unemployed and police who join Ford's security forces. Shots are fired into the crowd, killing four protesters. Republican Congressman Hamilton Fish, with the support of the American Federation of Labor, AFL, also introduces a measure to Congress to create a committee to investigate radical activities. This would become the House Un-American Activities Committee. Have you driven a Ford out of town lately? Also on March 6, 1965, civil rights demonstrations begin a march from Selma to Montgomery to protest the murder of Jamie Lee Jackson and to demand voting rights for blacks. They are brutally beaten by police officers while crossing the bridge in Selma. 67 are injured. The attack become known as Bloody Sunday. Lastly, on March 6, 1974, the Weathermen Underground bombed the Department of Health in San Francisco to protest forced sterilization of poor women. This week in radical history, from March 7th, John Fry's Rebellion, also known as the House Tax Rebellion, an armed tax revolt led by a Pennsylvania farmer, began in 1799 and ran through 1800. It would be suppressed by the government, and Fry's and two others sentenced to hang, later pardoned by the president. Also on March 7th, 1921, Trotsky orders the artillery bombardment of Kronstadt, entrenching the Bolshevik power and stopping any real chance of real reform in Russia. Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, feeling that their last tie to the Bolsheviks had been broken, decide to leave Russia and alert the world to what they have witnessed. Two more items for March 7, 1942. IWW founder, anarchist labor organizer, Lucely Parsons, dies. She's described by Chicago Police Department once as more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Lucely Parsons. Also in 1998, anarchist Jack Frager dies in New York. He is last arrested at age 88 during the Hiroshima Day protest for painting shadows of bomb victims on sidewalks in New York City. This week in Radical History for March 8, 1906. In the Philippines, U.S. occupations massacre an unruly band, mowing stubborn tribes people down with a combination of artillery fire and infantry assault. Men, women, and children are all slaughtered. Afterwards, President Roosevelt congratulates these brave Americans for, quote, a brilliant feat of arms within you, which upholds the honor of the American flag. Also on March 8, 1917, Cuba, U.S. invades Cuba for the fourth time. Also on this date in 1964, the first invasion of Alcatraz by Dakota Sioux, who claimed the island under the 1868 Sioux Treaty to remind America of the offer of government of $6.54 for the land, based on 49 cents per square acre, which is being considered proposed to be given for compensation for tribal Indian land stolen from California indigenous peoples. Yep, $6.54 for Alcatraz Island. Lastly, for March 8, 1971, 1,000 documents are stolen from the FBI office in Pennsylvania, later distributed in newspapers. Members of the Citizen Committee to Investigate the FBI, an arm of the Weathermen Underground, break into FBI offices revealing the existence of FBI's criminal COINTELPRO program, harassing domestic political dissidents. Here's a short segment about that from the documentary about the Weather Underground and COINTELPRO.
So there was a lot of outlaw culture.
Because of the way that this country is falling apart, more and more young people are living in communal situations. More and more young people are beginning to fight the government on various levels. And so there's a huge mass of people that people who are underground fugitives can move amongst and have protection from and be with.
The weathermen were extremely bright. Many of them had access to fairly substantial amounts of money, which is the key to staying underground. We didn't get them, but we came close. It was frustrating when you wanted to catch these people as much as we did. You weren't going to catch these people in the standard FBI approach of surveilling the house the night before grandma's 50th wedding anniversary. So the fugitive comes walking in with a gift. Bang, you got him. It wasn't going to work that way. The way that we decided to do was to basically go underground in essentially the same way they did, and use some investigative techniques which were very tried and true in the National Security Division.
They did break into people's apartments and steal things, did try to plant divisive stories among people who were working in the peace movement and the anti-war movement. And I had a whole strategy that included beating people up and dangling people out of windows. And, you know, it was not just light.
I know people who have liberal political tendencies would say it's terrible. People who don't would say that, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, nothing wrong is going to happen, nothing bad is going to happen to you.
In the early 1970s, a group of radicals calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and made off with several boxes of files. The documents, which were leaked anonymously to the press, revealed the existence of COINTELPRO, a secret FBI program to destroy a wide range of groups that opposed the U.S. government. The Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, even Martin Luther King. By the early 1970s, COINTELPRO had been largely effective.
The movement began to devour itself. There was the absence of all the things that made the movement so powerful. Absence of trust, absence of love, absence of a sense of humor, absence of commitment, absence of this communal, we're all in this together. All that stuff seemed to have been blown apart.
Don't let this happen to you.
Mother Earth says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey-o, 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 hey-o. And Father Sky says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh. ourselves, to be with one another, to be with our surroundings, to be, and we are here to take care of ourselves.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. In the course of gathering resources each week in preparation for This Week in Palestine, I read and listen to a myriad of articles, speeches, and presentations of various sorts, and did so again this week, and came across one of Mazen Kumsaya's email reports from Bethlehem. Mazen is a remarkable human being. He is a Palestinian geneticist who taught for many years at Duke University and Yale University, but eventually returned to his native Palestine, where he continues to teach, but also has developed a museum of natural history at Bethlehem University. He is also an activist involved in the resistance to the occupation. Mazen frequently writes email reports from Bethlehem, where he comments on his work in the museum and the latest political struggles. He often adds links to informative articles and reports. This morning I want to read a recent report that Mazen sent to his network. It is typical Mazen. Filled with struggle and news of the occupation, but also included glimpses of hope, always pointing to ways that we all can be involved in the resistance. Here is Mazen Kumsaya writing from Bethlehem. It remains a remarkable era that we live in, and it is getting more interesting every day. Take, for example, the poke in the eye that the Zionists did through their vassal president, Donald Trump, in deciding that the date to move the U.S. embassy to occupied Jerusalem will be May 15th. This is a very significant date because that date is Nakba Commemoration Day, when, against the wishes of the vast majority of inhabitants, a Jewish apartheid state was created by force of arms. Before and after that date, the largest post-World War II ethnic cleansing happened. Most of the native people of Palestine, of various religions, were pushed out and 530 towns and villages were depopulated. Today, 7 million people are refugees or displaced people. 6.3 million live under the direct Israeli racist rule. None have sovereignty over their lands. Immigrant Ashkenazi white European elites rule the apartheid state. The 1.6 million Palestinians who had lived under martial law until 1966 and then given some citizen rights, but are subjected to further ethnic cleansing, home demolitions, colonial settlement expansion, just as much as the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. There is a meticulous and vicious program of slow genocide in Gaza. In Jerusalem, West Bank, there are more and more pressures to Judaize the city by programs of denial of residency and recently the escalation of pressure on Christian and Muslims to strip them of church and mosque property by overtaxing them to bankruptcy in order to take their church and mosque property. This week, the Christian churches, including the Church of the Sepulchre, closed their doors in protest. To my knowledge, this has never happened before in 2,000 years. The world politicians are silent, and the Palestinian Authority issue feeble sounds of pleading for the world community to implement international law and also to protect the Palestinian people. Yet they all continue their failed policies and do not admit that they made any mistakes. As any rational reader of history knows, rights are never begged for from your oppressor. Oppressors must be forced to give up their powers. Resistance must be built up in all its forms, sanctioned by international law. Mahmoud Abbas, whose term expired years ago and whose health is deteriorating, wish him to finally retire, gave a speech at the UN Security Council in which he admitted that his authority basically works for the Israeli occupiers. Thus, the first and main obstacle now to liberation, return of refugees, self-determination in Palestine, is the Vichy government in Ramallah. It is long past time to end the charade of Oslo and create a real Palestine liberation organization. To be clear, Palestine is all of Palestine, not the disputed 22% of it, West Bank and Gaza, for which they have been negotiating endlessly. Liberation, as liberty, not accepting apartheid or the racist notions of a Jewish state. This also includes the right of native Palestinians to return to their homelands. Organization, as people organizing to capture the amazing energy of the 12.5 million Palestinians around the world. That requires participatory democracy, not a clique of comprador elites. Term limits of 6 to 8 years are a good idea for all leaders. Every day here, as we work the land and work with people, we see the incredible energy and incredible opportunities. Just this week, we planted over 200 native trees, carob, oak, azrael, pistachio, and worked with children from age 3 to 83. We launched projects on climate change, on sustainability, on biodiversity, on ecotourism, and on permaculture, one founded by the National Geographic. We watch our friends in Israeli jails, like four members of the Tamimi family in Munthar Amara. We miss some who departed recently. For example, we lost Gail Kure, a great friend of us and of all Palestinians. We planted a tree in her honor, and a mutual friend is donating money to the museum in her honor. Life goes on in all its ingredients, good ones and bad ones, people who lie and cheat and people who help and donate and work and give of themselves. We in Palestine and visiting and volunteer friends from around the world remain having joyful participation in the joys and the sorrows of this world. We trim the dead branches and see growth of new ones. Spring in Palestine is beautiful with a tapestry of colors of plants, smell of blossoms everywhere, taste of fresh winter crops from our garden and greenhouses, and the spirit of people who defied all odds. 60% of our people are under the age of 18, and we work with some of them regularly. We see hope in their eyes. Life is still good. We savor it. Join us as we refuse to behave like dead fish, but indeed swim against the current. Collectively, we feel alive by the effort and perpetuate humanity. That was vintage Mazen Kumsia, writing from Bethlehem, a voice that we need to continue to elevate. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is a presentation by Yousef Munayer, delivered at the Harvard JFK School of Government. Yousef Munayer is a writer and political analyst and currently is executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Here is Yousef Munayer speaking at the Harvard JFK School of Government.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. And thank you all for the kind invitation and for turning out tonight. It's great to see the turnout here, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I know in the flyer for this event I saw that it said that you'd be hearing a Palestinian perspective, and that is true. And sorry, the mic is not on.
Just closer.
How's that? Good? So as I was saying, I know the flyer said you'd hear a Palestinian perspective, and that is true. And while I do come to this issue as a student of politics and policy, I also come to this issue from other places as well, which is important for me to tell you about, I believe. I come first to this issue as a human being who happens to be Palestinian, who happens to also be an Israeli citizen, who happens to also be an American citizen. And despite any adventures and studies on this issue, I would be lying to you to say that those experiences did not help define and inform the perspective that I'm sharing with you today. So I was asked to speak about Trump's policy towards Palestine and his recent decisions regarding funding for UNRWA, as well as the Jerusalem decision. And we will cover all of those issues. But I want to begin by saying also to the students who are traveling to take the trek, you have no shortage of resources at this university. There's no shortage of information at your fingertips here. Fantastic historians, scholars, endless volumes of books on this conflict. There is nothing like seeing for yourself what is taking place on the ground. And so I'm very glad that you are going to be making this trip, and I look forward, if it is possible, to hearing from you again about your experiences there and what it is that you've learned. So with that, we turn to our topic now, and it is a well-timed moment to be discussing this. If you've been following the news today, there was a speech given at the United Nations Security Council by the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority, which is a rare event. And he laid out in his speech his reaction to the position of the American administration under President Trump and the shifts in policy that have been made since he has taken office, in particular regarding to the question of Jerusalem and American recognition of Jerusalem. But his message to the Security Council was bigger than just any particular policy issue. It was a message that asked for the international community to intervene in ways that they have not intervened before. And so, if we are to understand what it is that Trump has brought that is different to the question of U.S. policy on Palestine, I think it's important to understand a little bit what preceded it to fully appreciate the impact of the positions that he has taken and the shift that it represents. I think from a Palestinian perspective, it is fair to say that the peace process, as it has existed from the early 1990s through 2016, is one that Palestinians would have considered to be unfair and biased towards Israel because of the way in which it was mediated. And it was mediated, of course, primarily by Washington, with some exceptions for periodic multilateral interventions that ultimately end up being dominated by Washington at the end of the day. And when there are international interventions, like, for example, resolutions that come to the floor of the United Nations Security Council considering questions related to Palestine, whether or not they move forward is based largely on whether or not the United States will agree. And we know that over the last 30 years or more, there have been about 40 different resolutions, maybe up to 42 now, where the United States has been the single solitary veto in the United Nations Security Council on resolutions concerning the Israel-Palestine question. And so even when there are multilateral approaches to this issue, the United States finds a way to continue monopolizing the direction that it takes. And all of this, of course, is before President Trump. And immediately before President Trump, we saw at the United Nations Security Council a resolution that came to the floor in December of 2016. And this was, of course, after the election, but before the Trump administration took office, a resolution that the United States actually did not veto. They did not support, but they did not veto the resolution. And the resolution did a number of things. This is UN Security Council Resolution 2334. The resolution did a couple of different things. It condemned, of course, Israeli settlement expansion as being illegal under international law. And that was the headline that dominated the conversation around that resolution. But more importantly, I believe, one of the things that the resolution did, buried down in the text, was really let out a cry of desperation, the last gasps of the two-state solution as it relates to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And there it said that urgent steps had to be taken within a defined period of time to salvage the two-state solution. And so this is the context in which the transition from what has been, let's call it, conventional peace process policy, again, in the view of Palestinians, very much already biased towards Israel, to Trump peace process policy, which is something very different. So what is it that Trump brought that was very different? And before we get into that, I should say that in the immediate aftermath of that vote, as many of you will recall, the Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, delivered a very important speech at the State Department outlining the American rationale for why they took the decision that they did and why the position that they took was so important, not just for the Palestinians, but for Israel as well. And what he said in his speech, and I would urge all of you to go back and look at the text because it was an important message at the time, albeit in my view, many decades too late. What he said in the speech was that if there is no two-state solution, what you have between the river and the sea is essentially an apartheid regime. He did not use the word apartheid, though. The words that he used are ones that are much more familiar to our American context. He said what you have is separate and unequal. And of course, as Palestinians, we know, and I believe as Susan laid out very clearly, the policies of separate and unequal have been in place since the very advent of the state, written into law. Enter President Trump, or President-elect Trump at this point. We had indications of where President Trump's policy was going to go. The indications, of course, came from things that he said, and also the people that he put around him. Among the things that he said at during the campaign, for example, among the many, many different problematic things that he said, was a very sort of standard right-of-center approach to the Israeli-Palestinian issue delivered at the annual AIPAC convening in the summer. But it was after that that we began to understand a little bit more about exactly what his approach was going to be and who he was going to be surrounding himself with. In particular, his advisors on Israel, Jason Greenblatt and David Friedman. And if anyone is familiar with these two characters, you will know that they are not only very close to the politics of the Israeli right, but in many ways, the fringe of the Israeli right. And if you have followed the David Friedman saga, you will know, for example, that Friedman was not just an activist, a pro-settlement activist, but actually participated in the financing of Israeli settlements deep inside the West Bank, including some of the most ideological settlements and settlements that are really central to the vision of the settler movement. Which I think is important. And if you followed his writings in the right-wing fringe outlets in which he was publishing in Israel, you will have seen him argue essentially that there is no need for Palestinians to have equal rights, and also that Jews who disagree with Israel's policies, liberal Jews essentially, are equal to collaborators with the Nazis. So this is the person that is advising Donald Trump on Israel policy and was the first person who he named to a appointment as ambassador, and, of course, named him as ambassador to Israel. So we had a sense of where this was going. But it was not really clear what the specific policy shifts were going to be. So about a year ago, around this time, The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, came to the White House to visit, was, I believe, the first foreign leader after Theresa May to come to the United States, was embraced, of course, with open arms by President Trump shortly after the United States abstained on that veto. And standing beside Prime Minister Netanyahu, Donald Trump said something that many people found perhaps bizarre, funny at the time, maybe reflective of his, shall we say, lack of education on this issue. And he essentially said, well, our policy is one state, two state, whatever they want. Well, you know, whatever they want is good. And it was because of our familiarity with Donald Trump, it was very easy, of course, to dismiss this as a sort of Trumpism, if you will, as ignorance toward the issue. But I would say a couple things. First of all, anytime the President of the United States says something when it comes to policy, it is not insignificant, even if it is not intentional. But also, what we heard from Donald Trump is in many ways a continuation of previous American policy. And what I mean by that is the last administration sent out this call of desperation for the two-state solution. The next administration is starting to say, well, maybe time's up. Now, where are we going? I'm sure Palestinians have a very different vision than what Donald Trump and some of his advisors have. But the recognition that time is up, I think, is an important one to underscore. Second, it is a recognition of the reality that the parties themselves are no longer on the same page when it comes to the outcome of the negotiations, the goal of the negotiations. There was a time when the Israeli government at least played along with the notion that they desired a two-state solution. But I think it's very clear now that the current Israeli government, which has been in power for a number of years, and governments like it have been in power for a number of years, have been not shy to say that they're not interested in this anymore. So for the president to say, well, whatever the two parties agree on is also a reflection of the fact that the parties no longer agree in any public way about what the shared goal of these negotiations are. I think that is important. And it's important, thirdly, because it underscores a real shift in American policy, right? For decades, the conventional peace process policy was based on an outcome that included a Palestinian state. What the contours of that state were was up for negotiation. The degree of sovereignty that state had was up for negotiation. But that was the goal. This is a marked shift away from that. What we didn't understand at the time was that this was part of a bigger shift in American policy that Donald Trump would be introducing and unfolding over the period of the next year, and God knows there may be more to come. But I would call what we've seen so far a three-pronged attack on the conventional peace process policies that the United States has put forward in decades prior. This includes this ambiguity on the outcome, which is used to be very clear in terms of what the goal was, a two-state solution. Now that is no longer the case. Second is a significant shift on U.S. policy towards the issue of Jerusalem. And we all saw that take place in recent weeks and months, the fallout continuing, of course, to today. After the president recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, something he said he would do during the campaign, but also something that every American president in recent years has promised to do in the campaign cycles, but don't because they realize how big of a problem that would be for the stated goal of trying to achieve a two-state solution. Donald Trump changed that, and that's important to recognize. And the implications of this are significant because the peace process itself, as we know it, from the very foundation of these negotiations at the 1991 Madrid conference, was based on a set of American guarantees. Guarantees that the Americans gave to the parties and said, look, if you come to the table, we guarantee X, Y, and Z. Included in that was an American guarantee on the question of Jerusalem. Was that they would not recognize Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem, in particular until there was a negotiated outcome that the parties agreed on. Essentially, that this would remain an issue that would be put towards the end of an agreement, and only then would there be American recognition. So by shifting this, not only did Donald Trump shift decades of American policy that even preceded the peace process in 1991, he destroyed the very foundation that peace process that started in 1991 was built on. This is a major shift. The third of the three-pronged attack on the peace process policy is the change in the position towards UNRWA, the agency. And while this is most directly going to impact this UN agency itself, it is also tied to a narrative, an Israeli narrative, that is now increasingly being echoed by the Americans, and that is that the problems with UNRWA are not about the agency or its efficiency or anything like that, but the role it plays in perpetuating, again, this is the Israeli narrative, perpetuating the refugee crisis. So now this is no longer just an attack on the agency itself. And by attacking the agency, of course, an attack on Palestinian refugees who rely on that agency in very direct ways, but also an attack on the very idea of the right of return, which is the way in which this is being messaged and echoed by the United States if you pay very close attention to what is being said and done around this issue. So here you have a shift on the question of a Palestinian state, a shift on the question of Jerusalem, a shift on refugees. In 1 year, Donald Trump completely destroyed everything that was the foundation of an already flawed process. In some ways, I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with that because for a very long time, we were able to talk about a two-state solution for the sake of talking about a two-state solution without actually doing anything to get to that outcome. And as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton put it in emails that ultimately got leaked, a Potemkin process is better than no process at all. For Palestinians, that's not the case. We obviously do not feel that a ruse is going to help us in any way, and we would like serious engagement and solidarity from the international community to providing justice for our people. But for the United States and for Israel, a Potemkin process has a lot of benefits. And we'll get into that in a moment. But what this has revealed is that the peace process as we know it is over with. And even pretending now is no longer possible. It was possible in the past to pretend. Trump has made it impossible to pretend. And now those among us who were holding out, not wanting to confront the reality that this was a fiction, are forced to confront it. And we must ask the question, what comes next? And it is incumbent upon us to grapple with that. So, for those who are not familiar, I want to explain a little bit why, you know, from the Palestinian perspective, the peace process prior to Donald Trump was not exactly something that they had faith in. And I will do this by outlining what I refer to as the three central myths of the peace process, the conventional peace process. The first of these three myths is the idea that the creation of a Palestinian state is a U.S. national security interest. This is a lie. It is not true. It was claimed, particularly after 9/11, as part of the discourse around the need to address blowback in the region, that we have to get to a two-state solution because of that. But the reality is, it's not an American national security interest. It's not a secondary interest. Maybe it's a third-level interest. And what that means is the United States does not have an interest in expending any real serious resources towards making it happen. Unfortunately, that's how foreign policy works. And what that means is that when it comes to making decisions on these foreign policy issues, other considerations come into play, particularly domestic policy. Now, there are a lot of foreign policy issues that rise to the level of a national security interest, where a decision maker, where an executive will say, we have to put the domestic politics aside. This is a national security issue. Whatever the domestic politics are, we have to act in X, Y, Z ways. This is not that, despite the myth. The second myth of the peace process is this following statement, which unfortunately we heard echoed many, many times by the previous administration. And that is this: the status quo is unsustainable. The status quo is unsustainable. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which began in 1967, is now over 50 years old. It has sustained in the Middle East longer than Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, longer than Hosni Mubarak, longer than Gaddafi. Nothing in the Middle East has been as sustainable as the Israeli occupation, in large part thanks to U.S. policy. When we say, when our leaders say the status quo is unsustainable, they're not only lying. They're absolving themselves of their own responsibility in making this horrendous situation sustainable. Understanding that this is a myth is central to understanding what must come next. Finally, and again, these are in no particular order, but there are three. Ending the occupation is in Israel's interest. This is one we hear a lot. Because for some reason, the United States feels like it must convince Israel to do something that's good for it, and feels like it's in a position to define Israel's interests for it better than Israel is itself. That's not true, and it has never been the case. Not with Israel, not with any other country. But nonetheless, this is a myth that we keep telling. The reality is when it comes to the occupation, and when it comes to Israeli interests, there are many different intertwined layers of interests when it comes to entrenching the occupation and the notion of ending the occupation. And until you untangle that, until you understand what those economic interests are, what those political interests are, you cannot figure out a way forward. Until we are able to manipulate those interests, and we have many tools at our disposal to do that, if we are talking about policymakers, you cannot expect Israel to make the decision that it is going to end the occupation. The Israelis believe that continuing the occupation is in their interest. We are not going to convince them otherwise. Certainly not by continuing to pretend that it's unsustainable while making it sustainable. So the message that we send to the Israelis is, you should end the occupation, we'll tell everybody it's a crisis, but under the table, we'll give you several billions of dollars a year and ensure that you're protected in the United Nations Security Council. Wink, wink. So it is for these reasons that Palestinians never had faith in the previous process, and now with Trump here, it's easier for you all to see why. This brings us to the final topic that I was asked to speak to you about tonight, which is what is there for us to do about this? I think it is very clear, both from what Susan outlined, both from what I mentioned here today, and was also a central theme in what was said by Mahmoud Abbas at the United Nations today, is that the international system has failed on this issue. It has failed. Today, Abbas read off the numbers. I don't know how many hundreds of General Assembly resolutions and United Nations resolutions. Not the ones that have been presented and vetoed. The ones that have been passed but have never been enforced. The state system has failed Palestinians. And if the state system has failed Palestinians, what then can be done? Well, as you very appropriately ended your comments with, civil society has a role to play. And it is for this reason, it is because Palestinians had stared at the morass of the peace process for decades, long before Trump, that they decided that the state system was not going to save them. That they could not rely on the state system, certainly not the way that it was behaving at this point, to deliver accountability for Israeli behavior. And so Palestinians in 2005 initiated a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And in doing so, called for international solidarity in the use of these nonviolent tactics, these nonviolent forms of economic action, to hold Israel accountable until it abided by international law based on three central demands: an end to the occupation, the military occupation, which began in 1967, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel under the law, not any of this bifurcation between nationals and citizens that allows you to pretend that you have some sort of equality when you really don't, and a right of return for Palestinian refugees in accordance with international law, Susan so articulately laid out. So it is this movement, this civil society movement, launched in 2005 by members of Palestinian civil society, which is growing today around the world, which I believe at this current moment represents the single best hope for holding Israel accountable moving forward. It is certainly not residing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It never was. But it is residing here in this room. It is residing in rooms like this across the country. where people have an opportunity to wrestle with questions about their complicity in the oppression of Palestinians that continues to take place. And we as Americans have a particular responsibility, because not only are we making choices in a daily basis that are investing in one way or another in profiteering off of the denial of these rights, but our government is subsidizing these policies to the single largest foreign military financing expense in our budget. And so it is for this reason that when we look at what is taking place today in Washington, what has been taking place in Washington, that we continue to believe that only through these civil society efforts can things change. And ultimately, and I want to say this to be very clear, this is not my preferred method. I would much prefer that states in the international system lived up to their obligations and created policies that enforced international law when it comes to this issue. That would be my preference. That's not the case. That doesn't mean nothing can be done. And I believe that if we can work to build a movement across civil society to address accountability on this issue, one day we'll be able to create the kind of change necessary to get the states to ultimately play that role. So I will stop there.
You've been listening to Yusuf Munayyer of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, speaking at Harvard's JFK School of Government. Before we wrap up this morning, I want to quickly read one more news story that is reported this week by the Electronic Intifada, and I'm now quoting directly from the article. Israel froze a bill on Tuesday that would allow it to expropriate land sold by the Greek Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches to private developers, and postponed the collection of taxes from church-owned properties and United Nations institutions in Jerusalem. Israel's about-face comes after hundreds of Palestinians protested the measures and church leaders closed the doors of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, one of Christianity's most revered sites, which according to tradition marks the place where Jesus was crucified. The church closed for 3 days, but announced that it will reopen its doors on February 28th, following Israel's climb down. Earlier this month, Israeli authorities in Jerusalem moved to collect $186 million from 887 properties in the city belonging to churches and UN agencies by freezing their bank accounts. The organizations affected including UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Church leaders said Nir Barkat, the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem, was violating international treaties that exempt churches from state taxes. The Israeli municipality has already seized approximately $3 million from the Catholic Church, $2 million from the Anglican Church, $500,000 from the Armenian Church, and $161,000 from the Greek Orthodox Church. The heads of the Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and the Armenian churches, all three responsible for the Church of the Sepulchre, released a statement on February 25th condemning Israel's tax collection bill and its efforts to change the status quo of the city. The greatest victims in this are those impoverished families who will go without food and housing, as well as children who will be unable to attend school, they stated. This reminds us of the laws of similar nature which were enacted against the Jews during the dark periods in Europe. The denomination leaders call Israel's actions a systematic campaign of abuse against Christian churches, and churches now reaching its peak with this discriminatory and racist bill. The church hung a protest banner saying, "Enough is enough," with pictures of Israeli Mayor Barakat and Rachel Azaria, a member of the Israeli parliament, identifying them as the two main instigators of Israel's campaign against the Christian community. What worried church leaders the most, according to Israeli newspaper Haaretz, was a measure sponsored by Azaria that would allow Israel to expropriate the land sold by churches to private developers. A relevant question is what Israel would say if such a move was taken in another country for synagogue-owned property, Haaretz reported. The bill was set to be discussed by Israel's cabinet on Sunday, but was postponed following the church's closure. That was an excerpt from a report by the Electronic Intifada concerning Israel's attempt to tax Christian churches and even the United Nations. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives. Jobs, incomes, debts, the interest rates we pay, those our children are facing, and those coming down the road in an economy that is changing and changing fast. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and that I hope has prepared me to offer you these interpretations and analyses of what's going on in the economy around us. My eyes were caught recently by an article in New York Magazine that in turn was based on a research paper produced by the National Bureau of Economic Research. Both the National Bureau paper and the New York Magazine article were published in January 2018. And they ask and they try to answer the following question. Did the Democrats and the Democratic Party let unions die? I want to deal with the question in terms of focusing on one word, let. That implies that the Democratic Party was a passive kind of observer. Maybe it should have intervened, but in effect it let something happen. The implication being it could have and it would have happened anyway, and they just let it happen. It might be comforting to people in the Democratic Party to look at the world that way and to read our history that way, but I think it's a mistake. I don't think the Democratic Party let the labor unions die. I think the Democratic Party was a major instrument for extinguishing that movement in the United States, and let me explain. All of this starts in the great crash of the 1930s. We had before that pretty much a Republican-dominated economic and political system. Republican Party was in power when the Great Depression hit in 1929, Herbert Hoover and all the rest. And out of the Great Depression came a complete realignment of politics in the United States. And at the very pinnacle of that realignment was the Democratic Party. Why? Because the Democratic Party, led at the time by Franklin Roosevelt, made a deal with the trade unions in order to deal with the Great Depression. Basically, the deal went like this. We, the Democratic Party, will stand up and do things for working people. In exchange, we want you in the working classes of America to support the Democratic Party. And the deal worked. It worked very well. Let's go through it. The Democratic Party got the enthusiastic support of the overwhelming majority of working people. They voted Mr. Roosevelt into office four successive presidential terms. No person in American history had ever served four terms. No politician had ever been as popular as Franklin Roosevelt. The Democratic Party and Franklin Roosevelt rolled into office and stayed into office across the entire Great Depression and across the entire World War II that followed. And what did the working people get? Well, when you think about it, quite a bit. They got the Social Security system for the first time in American history. When you reach age 65, your working life behind you, most of it, you could have a decent, comfortable retirement. The government made a commitment to make sure you got that, as an honor to the work of your lifetime. We got unemployment insurance. If you lose your job through no fault of your own, the government will arrange to provide you with a check each week to see you through your hard times. A minimum wage was passed so that any working American would earn enough for a decent minimum standard of living. And finally, a public works program in which unemployed people, millions of them, got the jobs that would allow them to continue paying their mortgages, to keep their homes, to keep their dignity, their sense of self, and to be productive members of the community. The working people got a lot, and the Democratic Party got a lot, and they ruled the roost. But of course, somebody had to pay for all of these things. And who was that? Corporations and the rich had to pay a big chunk of it. Roosevelt told them, you must pay because you're the only ones who have the money to do this, and the country won't hold together. It'll blow apart, it'll have a revolution, it will dissolve if we don't take care of the tens of millions suffering through the Great Depression, asking only that they get a job. And enough of the corporations and the rich saw the wisdom of what Mr. Roosevelt did, so he got the taxes and he got the loans he needed to make that deal with the working people. But when the war was over, the corporations and the rich decided they had had enough of this arrangement. They didn't like it. They didn't want to keep being taxed and have their money withdrawn to help average people. And so they saw their vehicle as the Republican Party. But they also saw that in order to win, being Republicans wouldn't do it. They had to destroy the coalition that made the Democratic Party powerful. And what was that? It was the labor movement, together with the left wing of American politics, socialists, communists, and all kinds of other ists that felt themselves part of that democratic thing called the New Deal coalition. So the Republicans who didn't like it went to work to destroy that coalition. They started with the communists, whom they painted as the evil agents of a foreign power. When they were finished destroying them, they went after another part of the coalition, the socialists, and destroyed them. And when they were done, they went after the third biggest leg of the coalition, the labor movement, and demonized them, often using the same words and language that they had used against the communists and the socialists. What did the Democratic Party do confronted with this head-on assault on the coalition that had brought them to power? The basic answer to that question is, instead of confronting and stopping and reversing the assault, they joined it. First they joined to get rid of the communists, then they joined to get rid of the socialists, and in the end, they didn't have the strength to prevent the assault on the labor movement, which they kind of half endorsed anyway. So they weren't passive. They were part of the very reaction against the success of the Democratic Party. They didn't let unions die. They destroyed the coalitions that had built the unions up. They destroyed the coalition that the unions, together with the left in American politics, had used to come to power. The Democrats were not passive. They were active. That only makes the tragedy of their weakness today all the worse. The next update I want to deal with has to do, well, it's hard to put it. The best way to say it is the irrelevance of the government. We live in a capitalist system in which we pay an enormous amount of attention to what the government does. But I'm afraid it's because we overestimate how important the government is. Let me try to explain very concretely. In 2016, the last year of the presidency of Barack Obama, how many jobs were created in the United States? 2.34 million. By the way, 2+ million jobs were created. Mostly those jobs go to the new people entering the labor force. The population of the United States is growing. We have over 300 million people, so we add millions every year to the labor force. So when I say to you we created as a society 2.34 million jobs, it means we barely kept up with the growth in population. What about the first year of Donald Trump's administration? How many jobs were created? 2.17. Okay? So 2.34 million jobs created the last year of Obama. 2.17 million jobs created first year of Trump. Why is this interesting? First, Mr. Trump's boasts, as usual, turn out not to be accurate. He isn't the greatest job-creating president in the history of the world. He couldn't even match Mr. Obama's in his last year. So much for that, but that's not the really interesting thing. Notice how close they are. Under Obama, we created 170,000 more jobs. Now, for those people, of course, very important. But out of 2.5 or almost 2.5 million, it's kind of small potatoes. What's going on here is that what the president does doesn't matter. The number of jobs created in this country depends on the viability and functioning of the capitalist system as an economy, and the role of the government is not that important. We spend way too much time talking about what the government does or doesn't do, and way too little talking about how this system works. Finally, if the number of jobs created under Obama and Trump are very close, yet we know that the unemployment rate dropped drastically across the year 2017, the first year of Trump, then we can kind of see that it had nothing to do with Mr. Trump. What it had to do with, the reason unemployment went down, was because large numbers of unemployed people left the labor force, aren't looking for work anymore, and so they're not counted as unemployed. The decline in the number of unemployed is more about discouraged workers who don't even look anymore than it is about job creation, because as you can see, fewer jobs were created under Trump when the unemployment rate went down than under Obama when it didn't. Next item. Three international banks were fined early in February, a total of $47 million for manipulating contracts for futures. That's a kind of security gamble in the stock market. I know this is old stories, that banks are being fined is something I keep coming back to now for years in the United States. But I wanted to read to you and draw a lesson from this latest one. Three big international banks, together, $47 million. Well, I have to say again, $47 million for three huge international banks is as if I found you guilty of a major crime and insisted that the punishment was if you would give me 82 cents. You would reach into your pocket, throw the change at me, and laugh. That's what ought to be done here, but in our mass media, we don't do that. Listen to the statement of United States Department of Justice Assistant Attorney General Cronin in commenting on the misdeeds of these three banks that got this mild slap on the wrist. I'm quoting, "Their behavior reflects a disturbing and reckless trend of individuals and companies seeking to put illicit gains and profits above honest and law-abiding conduct." Oh, goodness. Sounds like my teacher from civics class long ago. Honest and law-abiding conduct? This fine, if that's the crime that they sought illicit gains and profits, the fine is an outrage, and it is simply the latest string in the illegal or unethical behavior of big banks. But what strikes me, as it always has, is we have yet another in the long string of criminal or unethical behavior that the leading officials in the government themselves call illicit gains and profits and reckless and disturbing. But no one seems to imagine that one response to private banks doing this is to substitute government banks, banks that are accountable to the people we elect, accountable even to us. No one seems to go that direction, even though many banks in most other capitalist countries are public. It's not as though we've never seen it. It's not as though we don't know that in North Dakota we have a bank that's public, run by that state, that's been there for 100 years and has a clear track record of making fewer mistakes and paying better dividends to the people of North Dakota than these big banks do anywhere else in the world. And why does no one say, wait a minute, if these banks are always engaged in illicit activity, maybe what they need is some sunshine, some light to come in. Maybe they need the banks to be run as cooperatives so all the people in the bank know what's going on and all the people in the bank have power so that they can catch and identify and deal with criminal and or unethical behavior. Here would be some solutions that solve this problem. Instead, we give them small fines, we slap them on the wrist, and then we act all shocked and surprised when one after another of these officials, year in and year out, is caught for every kind of crooked behavior that private enterprise has ever displayed anywhere.
This is Economic Update on listener-supported KPFA Radio. I'm Mitch Jezrich coming to you from our studios in Berkeley. And I do need just this moment of your time before we return to today's program. 1 week from today, we will be wrapping up our winter 2018 fund drive. And in that, we are really beginning our final stretch. We're over, way over halfway through this fund drive. However, towards our overall goal, financial goal money that we have to raise to keep this radio station fully operational. Well, we're not even quite halfway towards the goal, even though now it looks like we're about 60-65% of the way through this fund drive. That said, my pledge to you today is the same as before. If we are able to get to our $3,000 goal today, next week, even if it's our final day of the fund drive, we will still, and I will pledge to you that we will still bring the vast majority of Economic Update to you to bring you the show that you tune in for. Now, this all said, I do have to tell you, last week we failed to make our $3,000 goal. And so this week it's really important. I wasn't just going to sort of end this promise of bringing the program to you just because we didn't make it last week. But however, it does get more difficult if we are unable to make that goal. So it's important that we make that $3,000 goal today. I'm asking you for a pledge to support this radio program that allows me to continue to bring it to you as it is, with just limited interruptions each week during our fund drive. Our phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. Now, a $25 pledge to the radio station will make you a basic member. $50 gets us $50 closer to our overall $3,000 goal for this hour. We're going to have to average about $100 per pledge, but that could be one person pledging $25, another person pledging $175. It could be somebody out there who can afford a $500 or a $1,000 contribution. The way we make this work is everyone does according to their own means. If everyone participates, and that means you, then we will make it through and we'll make it by as a community, hence community radio. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 and online at kpfa.org. We now return to Economic Update.
When Mr. Trump came to office the same month, November 2016, he immediately brought lobbyists who had been working for private enterprises into the government. He got caught doing that, which directly violated what he had promised in his campaign. So he announced a new rule making it illegal for 5 years. There was a ban on lobbyists. It was a big, see how strict I am, and I'm not doing what I promised I wouldn't do. I'm really a hard-nosed anti-lobbyist guy. There was a provision in the little thing he did there that you could waive the requirement of no lobbyist in the previous years and no lobbyist afterwards, after your government service. And of course, the waiver has been used over and over again ever since. No draining of the swamp, if anything, an expansion of the swamp. But one of them caught my eye, and I need to tell you about it. This has to do with Ms. Kaylee, and I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Tikaz. She has become an advisor to the Secretary of Agriculture with respect to, now this is key, dietary guidelines for Americans. In other words, she's now working in the government to provide guidelines for what we teach our children and ourselves is good for us to eat and drink and what is not. Okay, guidelines are issued every 5 years. She's going to be working on that because she's an expert. Now, let me tell you about where she comes from to give you an idea of what kind of expertise she will be contributing. Here we go. Kaylee Takacs was director of food policy for the Corn Refiners Association, a trade group for corn syrup manufacturers. For 2 years before leaving for the Trump administration in July 2017, that's what she did. The Corn Refiners Association makes corn syrup, which is a sweetener. It's a sweetener that has been shown to have all kinds of health effects that are not good and to be nutritionally dangerous, if not useless. Prior to that, she lobbied for the Snack Food Association and the National Grocers Association. Prior to her lobbying days, she spent a year as a research analyst on tax policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. What is that? ALEC, it's called. A group of corporations and conservative lawmakers that work together to craft business-friendly model legislation. She also spent the year before that at the Charles Koch Institute, named after its billionaire founder and CEO and part owner of the global fossil fuels and materials conglomerate, Koch Industries. The Corn Refiners Association, where she worked just before going into the government, consists of the four biggest corn syrup producers in the United States: Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, Ingredion, and Tate and Lyle. She then lobbied the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, as well as the House, Senate, and Environmental Protection Agency, trying to get dietary guidelines that were interesting to and supportive of her corporate clients. That's not keeping lobbyists at a distance. That's keeping lobbyists closer to you than your undershirt. Next item. Trump has been dialing back regulations across the board, and particularly working to dilute Dodd-Frank together with the Republican majorities in both the House and Senate. The Dodd-Frank law was supposed to regulate banks. So it came as no surprise with the reduction of these regulations to discover that banks are now lending loans deemed as risky as what they were just before 2008. It leads me as an economist to question, is it the situation that the bankers learned nothing from the 2008 crash? And now that the regulations are being withdrawn by Trump, they can go and do it all again? Or are they in fact quite smart? They did learn something. What they learned is that even if they fail, they'll be bailed out at taxpayer expense. So then why not? I don't know how to answer that question. I leave it to you, because either way, the message, when you think about it, is pretty much the same. Finally, we live in a society of unprecedented inequality of income and wealth. You know, 35 years ago, the United States was one of the least unequal of the major capitalist countries. Today, we are the most unequal. I don't blame Mr. Trump. This has all been happening for 30 or 40 years. But here we sit as one of the most unequal societies in the world. And we have tried as a nation, over the years, a whole host of things to try to undo that inequality, to reverse it, to modify it. The war on poverty. And I could go through the list of policies we've had. They haven't worked. inequality is worse, not better. The efforts we made, the laws we changed, the tax situation we changed, the special skills we taught, the special job opportunities we created, it didn't work. And I want to offer an explanation why and what to do about it. I think the efforts, well-intentioned as many of them were, undertaken by both Republicans, Democrats, and others, didn't take account of the key issue, which is the system we live in. And by that I mean capitalism, because it has a name. And I want to be very clear about what I mean. In a capitalist system, enterprises, and most of them are corporations, as you know, or you should know, most of our economy is run by corporations. In a corporation, a handful of institutions and people own the bulk of the shares, and they use those shares that they own to elect, one share, one vote, the board of directors of the company, the people who run the big corporations, General Motors, General Electric, General everything else. And now comes something that should surprise no one. If a tiny group of people, major shareholders in most companies, 20, 30, 40, that's it. Board of directors in most companies, 12 to 20 individuals, that's it. They may have thousands of employees, tens of thousands of employees, but the number of people at the top is always the same. Very, very small minority of those engaged in any corporation, in every corporation. Here's the thing that should surprise no one. If you allow a small number of people to be in that position of power, you cannot be surprised if they take the profits that the enterprise earns, the corporation earns, profits that all the workers there help to produce. You cannot be surprised if they at the top, who dispose of them all, give disproportionate amounts of them to themselves. Of course they decide to distribute dividends to shareholders. They're the major shareholders. Of course they decide to give huge salaries to the top managers who sit on the board of directors, because those are the people they work with. Those are the people themselves who make the decisions, and they enrich themselves. You can't really be surprised that for the mass of people that are not part of the running of the company, they don't get the big bucks. They never did. The way you overcome inequality, the way you make less inequality, is by changing this system. If the distribution of the profits everybody helped produce were distributed democratically by everybody, they would never give a handful of people the bulk of what they all helped to produce. They would distribute it much less unequally. And let me say the same thing the other way. If you don't deal with that institutional arrangement, if you don't deal with that structure of the enterprise, all your efforts at an equalizing of our inequality will come to the sad end that we just saw. They won't work. It's a sobering lesson, but it tells you where the solution lies. We've come to the end of the first half of this program. I want to thank you for being with us. And I remind you, stay with us. I think you'll find the second half of today's program very interesting.
And we're going to get to the second half of today's economic update. But first, I want to give you an update on our fundraising efforts today. We do have a goal for this hour of $3,000. We're hoping there are enough people out there to pledge what they can afford, what they can feel good about, what they feel is reasonable for themselves, and what they think a show like Economic Update is deserving of. We have raised $800 towards that $3,000 goal. So we're not quite a third of the way to the goal, and we are halfway through today's program. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And you can also pledge online at kpfa.com. www.ecnomicupdate.org. We have a phone room full of volunteers right now, people that are donating their time and donating their labor to this radio station to ensure that we could bring you a program like Economic Update each Friday at 10 a.m. You are the one that makes it possible. And let me just quickly say, again, last week we did not make our goal. And my pledge has always been, if we can make that $3,000 goal, next time we'll bring the show largely intact again, even if we are in Fund Drive. And of course, next week will be our last day of Fund Drive. It's important for us to make that $3,000 goal because this is one of our most listened to programs. And it is my job, my responsibility, to raise funds for this program. And hence there's a level of pressure, you will understand, because it is such a listen to program, to make it also significant for our fundraising efforts to keep this radio station on the air. Yet I know why you tune in. You tune in because this is an exceptional radio program, and I want to be able to bring you the program you tune in for. So I'm asking you for that contribution today. Let's try to make that $3,000 goal. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. We now return to Economic Update.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's edition of Economic Update. I'm very pleased today to address a topic with a guest, a topic that we have not devoted enough attention to, and it's broadly defined as the relationship between law, the practice of law, the justice, criminal justice system, on the one hand, and the economy on the other. If we're going to do economic updates, we have to also update the relationship between the law and the economy, and it's a very important one. My guest today is Leonard Goodman. He's a Chicago criminal defense lawyer with 25 years' experience. He has done both high-profile and indigent law. He's been a champion of defendants on both levels. He's also won cases at literally every level in both state and federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court. His current clients include the former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich. I hope is the right pronunciation. His work on behalf of the wrongfully convicted has won awards, such as for an Afghani man held for 12 years at Guantanamo Bay without charges before his release in December 2014. Currently, Leonard Goodman is an adjunct professor at the DePaul University College of Law and a member of the advisory board of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University College of Law. He also founded the Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting, which supports independent journalists doing investigative projects. He writes frequently for In These Times magazine on law and politics. It is a pleasure to welcome Leonard Goodman to Economic Update. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's jump right in. Given current headlines in the United States, would you say that politics, in some sense, is part of the legal system, plays a key role in the legal system? And the reason I ask is that, at least in high school and so forth, we were always told that the law stands somehow above the political fray, is some neutral arbiter of our differences. And I wanted to get your reaction as a practicing attorney.
I would say that politics, it does affect the criminal justice system probably in three ways. I mean, the one way that I think is in the news now is pure politically motivated investigations and prosecutions, which people are talking about because of the release of this memo, which does seem to show, that highly politicized opposition research found its way into a criminal investigation of Trump and his associates during the election. I think that's the most rare. I think more common, you do see the federal government use its power to protect the interest of corporations. We see that with, I mean, you could look at what's going on in with the pipeline protesters and the federal government and the FBI getting involved in infiltrating some of those protest groups and aggressively prosecuting. There was a case a while back, some of your listeners may remember Aaron Swartz, who was really an activist for a free internet. And he downloaded some copyrighted materials, not for personal profit, but to release them to the public. And he was aggressively prosecuted, threatened with decades in prison, and he took his own life, tragically. So there are those cases. I would actually say that you see the use of the federal government to aid corporate interests more starkly with the Department of Defense and what goes on with our military, where policies that just seem to not be serving the interests of the public, but do serve the interests of the weapons manufacturers, do serve the interests of oil and other mineral extraction industries throughout the Middle East and Africa. So I think probably the most common way that politics plays into the criminal justice system in who is in, who doesn't get prosecuted. So, for example, we had a systematic fraud in the mortgage markets that caused countless people to lose their homes. People were swindled out of their homes. People, probably more of them, people of color, lost their homes and a majority of their wealth in this. And the federal government, if you look at, for example, press releases that come out of, you know, my neck of the woods in Chicago, they'll talk about how the Department of Justice is pursuing an aggressive, coordinated, and proactive effort to bring to justice the perpetrators of mortgage fraud schemes. But as Eric Holder candidly admitted in 2013, they don't prosecute bankers. He basically said that these institutions have become too large, it's too difficult to prosecute them, whatever the excuse is, too big to jail, they say. But who does go to jail? And it's generally the politically powerless. I've represented many, many people charged with mortgage fraud. All of them are very low-level people, people that were encouraged by the banks and loan officers during the go-go 2000s to take out these loans that everyone knew they couldn't pay back. They were told, don't worry, you're going to be able to refinance, and you can buy these properties, and you could beat Donald Trump and, you know, be in real estate. And a lot of these people went to real estate courses to learn how to do this. And they were encouraged to inflate their income. In fact, the banks set up these programs. They were nicknamed liar's loans. They were technically called stated income loans, where you say you're in income, and we will not check. So that's what these people did. And they bought several properties, and they thought they fixed them up, and they tried to, you know, be real estate, and the market crashed. And now these people are going to prison. They're aggressively prosecuted by the Department of Justice. And when they get out of prison, the federal government comes after them to pay restitution to Wells Fargo Bank or to Bank of America or Citibank or whoever held the loan and lost money. So it's quite...
Whereas the people at the top who designed this whole system and ran it Walk away. Is this different now? Would you say, you know, as a teacher in a law school, you're familiar with the history, in a way, of the law, legal system in the United States. Is it worse? Is it better? Is it the same? Is this the same old, same old? How? Give us a sense of the politicization or the unfairness, in a way, of the justice system historically somehow.
What I would say is that we've seen, this is not new. I mean, certainly we've seen throughout history, you remember how Martin Luther King was aggressively investigated, especially when he started, becoming more of a threat to the corporate state and the war in Vietnam and income inequality.
Marching with those public works employees in Memphis and so forth,
right.
I remember.
You remember the COINTEL program of the FBI, where they went after people that were considered a threat, the Black Panthers, American Indian movements. So certainly we've seen this throughout history. I mean, even you'll remember Karl Rove was famous for, you know, advocating the firing of U.S. attorneys that did not help Republicans win election. That was a big scandal back then. But I would say the difference today is that the corporate state has really captured both of our two political parties in a way that I think we haven't seen in recent history. And because, you know, you can even go back to the late 80s under George H.W. Bush in the early 90s. He prosecuted, and that Department of Justice prosecuted, thousands of bankers in the savings and loan scandal, which was really a much less egregious scandal than what we've seen today with the mortgage fraud. Zero today, and back then thousands of bankers had actually went to prison, have felonies. So I think things are moving in a troubling direction, I would say.
How would you describe it, this direction? I mean, tell us what you think is unfolding here.
You know, and I'm not a political scientist, but, you know, you can look back at the Clinton. Certainly one thing you could look back at the Clinton years when basically a decision was made that the Democratic Party was going to grab the money from Wall Street, just like the Republicans, grab the money from defense contractors and arms industry, health insurance companies. And you can also look at what's happened to the unions in this country and sort of the undermining of the unions. I mean, it used to be that working people had a real voice in our duopoly political system, and today I think it's less so. So I think that feeds the income inequality and the sort of slanting of the playing field in favor of the people who basically the big donors to our political.
Really important conversation that Richard Wolf is having with Leonard Goodman, who is an attorney that specializes on how the corporate world and the legal world intersect. And let me also say, only on KPFA, and would you ever find a conversation between Richard Wolf and the attorney for Rod Blagojevich? You are listening to Economic Update on KPFA Radio. I'm Mitch Jezerich. A quick fundraising update before we get into this. Really, this is where the rubber meets the road, right? When how the justice system and the economic system or the corporate world intersect, and who's really looking after who in this world, and who is guarding the hen house. My friends, before we get back to this conversation, I do want to give you a fundraising update. At this moment, we've raised $1,800 towards our $3,000 goal. We are $1,200 away. However, we have just 16 minutes remaining in the hour. Again, as always, what I want to tell you is my pledge to you is if we can make that $3,000 goal, it would be really important for us and also gives me the proper cover that I'll need in order to ensure that next week, even though it will be the final day of our winter 2018 fund drive, we'll still bring you the program that you tune in for. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. And before we go back, let me tell you, we have a real opportunity to make this goal today, not only make it, but go beyond it, which again gives me a little more cover that allows me to do this, because we have three callers. Three donors, Muhammad in Fremont, Lourdes or Lourdes, perhaps, in San Francisco, and Mike in Antioch. Antioch, that's the city I was born in, Delta Memorial Hospital. Anyways, Mike in Antioch. These three people collectively are putting up $1,000 for a challenge. And what that means is if we could raise an additional $1,000 between now and the top of the hour, that would actually be $2,000 for us. We go beyond the goal for today, but our average will get us beyond the goal where we should be and would make up for the shortfall that we had last week. It's an opportunity for you to double your donation to this radio station and to double your impact. Of course, this is a lot of money we're talking about. And so if we don't make it, you know, you just don't want to throw money at something that's not going to make it, right? So if we do not make this $1,000, we'll have to offer Mohammed, Lourdes, and Mike their money back. This challenge begins now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. We now return to Richard Wolf's interview with Leonard Goodman.
You know, Leonard Cohen, cracks let in the light. Leonard Cohen has a song, my favorite song, whose title is Everybody Knows. Mm-hmm. And you put those two together, and it's just what you say. Everybody knows that we're not allowed to know. And there sits the danger of a society spinning out of control. I also love your image of that train, because for me as an economist, what I see is an ever smaller part of the population accumulating an ever larger amount of money in a society that is at least nominally democratic, where everybody has the vote, and these wealthy people, a tiny group, are very clear, and they're right, that's dangerous for them, that sooner or later the mass of people are going to use what they have, the vote, to undo the inequality of the economy. So they have to control the politics, otherwise they're not secure, so they buy the political system to prevent it from doing what it was there to do. But then you have the end result is a society that's on a runaway train of self-accumulation. I was asked very recently on a television program to comment on that tax cut. Was the same thing for me, the one in December. Because here you are, the rich are already richer than ever. They've become more rich relative to everybody else for 30 years. And you pass a tax cut that gives all the benefits to those who need it least. There's something wrong in that picture. And I have the sense that in the law, you're telling us something very parallel is underway. Is that a fair sense of
I think that...
Fine to disagree,
No, I do agree, because I think when you're talking about an imbalanced society, you need law enforcement, and people basically need law enforcement to keep order, because like what you're describing is a society where you have the 90% have really no representation, because the only candidates we get to vote for are corporate-approved candidates.
For either party.
Right. And so what is, so you're going to see unrest, and you're going to need the federal criminal justice system to really protect the interests of that 1%. And it is a scary situation.
You told me some examples you gave me when we were preparing for this, and I wanted to draw you out a little bit about them. Tell me what you think is going on in the law around campaign donations, which is a topic of enormous interest to our audience, because it gets right at this. What's that about? What upsets you, if I can say it that way, in that area?
What we see, and I, in full disclosure, I represent Rod Blagojevich, who is in prison for political corruption, they say. But if you look at the system, the candidates that really play the game right, that is, they get their funding from Wall Street, from the defense industries, they do their bidding, those people are left alone. Generally,
they kind of move up the ladder, the political ladder.
Yeah. It's certainly a corrupt arrangement. I mean, if you're sitting on the banking committee overseeing banks and you're taking, you're being funded by Wells Fargo and Citibank, it's insane, really. I mean, or if you're sitting on the Defense Appropriation Committee and you're taking money from Raytheon and General Dynamics and Northrop Grumman, and then you are voting, using your power to make sure that we're sending weapons all over the world.
And giving these companies huge contracts and all that.
So, it is an out-of-balance system. I'm sorry, I lost track of your question.
No, it's a very good phrase because it's very nice and polite. The real question is
about political corruption, yes.
And the campaign this money-changing hands. Like you, I feel as though 30 years from now, people will look back, or 50 years from now, look back at this and find it incredible that we could allow this. Almost to the level of pretending it isn't happening when it is as stark as your example just gave.
So, what I would say, though, is that what happens, it's similar to the mortgage fraud cases, is that because they don't go after the people that are actually in the pockets of the accepted donors of both parties, they go after, because they have to make, the federal government has to has at least create the illusion that they are interested in political corruption. So in Chicago, generally, they go after aldermen, mostly people of color, who, you know, stings are set up so that they'll take $1,000 or $2,000 an envelope and, you know, approve some bill, and those people go to prison and are aggressively prosecuted. So it's really, you know, the problem is when the game is rigged and the people, you know, at the top are untouchable, somebody has to get prosecuted. We have this huge apparatus, Department of Justice. I mean, just in Chicago, I think there's 70 full-time federal prosecutors. They're all very smart. They went to Harvard and Stanford and Yale, and they're, you know, excellent prosecutors. And so they have to have someone to prosecute. They can't prosecute the actual perpetrators of mortgage fraud. You know, they go after street crime and low-level people.
Thank you very much, Leonard Goodman.
Thank you,
coming.
Rick. Professor, it was a pleasure.
Thank you all for paying attention as well. Thanks again, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
And I do hope that you enjoyed today's program of Economic Update. I know I always do. I always have these little aha moments as I am following, whether it be the discussions or the lectures or updates that Richard Wolff gives on this radio program. It's something of real value. And I think if you've ever experienced spending an hour with Richard Wolff's Economic Update and found it valuable, helped understand the world of economics and how we function in the world and how economics affects us, because oftentimes we don't even realize they're affecting us. We think, well, the economy is doing great. It said on the news, the stock market is bullish, though not right now, not after these new tariffs that were put into place. But anyways, we'll get to that in a moment. But you know, things, all these things seem to, you know, the unemployment rate is so low, and all of these things. And yet, why am I struggling? Right. Well, thanks to Richard Wolff, he sort of makes this clear of, you know, there are a lot of factors, at play, that we're not being told about. And this is one of those radio programs I think helps bring back the curtain a little bit and allows us to understand how economics affects even our daily lives. So if you appreciate that, I want to ask you to make a contribution today to KPFA during our winter 2018 fund drive. $25 pledge is going to make you a member of this radio station, and we are going to thank you for that $25 pledge and welcome you to the family. $75 pledge helps us get that much closer to our $3,000 goal. We're going to have to average about $100 per pledge for us to be able to make it. But my friends, that's someone pledging $75, another person pledging $125. That's one person who's able to do so pledging $500 or $600. And really what you're doing is you are pledging for folks who perhaps cannot afford that contribution themselves right now. But we're glad they're there too, because the beauty of all of this is here is something you can get for free, and it must remain free because this is information for the people. But we also know without voluntary acts of giving and of donating, then it won't be available for anyone. Never mind the people who are donating, but also the people that cannot afford that donation, but yet are also moved by this radio program and other radio programs that you get on this radio station. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. Now, we do have a challenge. I want to give you an update on that challenge. Mohammed in Fremont, Lourdes in San Francisco, and Mike in Antioch together have come up and are challenging us to raise $1,000 if we are able to do that. And it was really in our final 15 minutes of the program. If we are able to raise that $1,000, then combine Muhammad, Lourdes, and Mike will also donate $1,000. And that, my friends, will get us over the top for our goal today and also help me make up our shortfall that we had on this program last week. Phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. I should tell you, we are halfway towards that, a little over halfway towards that $1,000 challenge. We are at $550, $450 to go. It's an opportunity for you to double your donation to this radio station, to double your impact. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And I'm encouraged today because we are doing it, I think, the way we should be able to do it. We're asking you to support. We're getting back to the root of what public broadcasting is about, recognizing that this is something that you could get for free and it must remain that way. It's important. This is information for the people, but also understanding that if everyone just took it for free and didn't make a donation when they can, well, then it wouldn't be available for anyone. And imagine not having this program, Economic Update, on each week at Friday, on Fridays, to help broaden our horizons and maybe even deepen our day. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And the reason this makes me happy is because this is what we're achieving right now. We have a number of $25 pledges, we have a number of $50 pledges, we have a number of $100 pledges, and we have several very large pledges in here as well. And I'm going to start thanking folks here because I want to make sure we do that before the hour is over. But that's how it's done. Everyone according to their own means. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. Diane in San Jose, thank you so much for your continued support of KPFA. We also have on here a Skip in San Francisco. Skip, thank you. Nina in Sebastopol, right, coming through from the North Bay, and now let's get into the South Bay. San Mateo is Linda. Linda, thank you for your support. Thank you for your little kind note on here as well. Linda and Nina and Skip, I want to make sure I'm getting everyone here. I don't want my ADD to ADD, dyslexia. I got them all, but don't want my dyslexia, as point proven right there, to get in the way of making sure I get everyone's name correct here. Jeffrey in Sebastopol. Jeffrey, thank you for your continued support to this radio station. Charlie in San Francisco. Charlie, generous of you. Thank you. George in Petaluma, also extremely generous of you, George. Thank you. And then we have James in Coarse Gold. Oh, I know that's somewhere down in the Central Valley, right? Because I don't know of any place named Coarse Gold right around here, but what a that's a good name, Coarse Gold. James, thank you. Franklin in Marina. Franklin, thank you. Linda in Healdsburg. Linda, thank you so much for your contribution as well. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
most people do think of it as in the way that you said, that the book is a handbook for tyrants, basically, and that Machiavelli thought that sometimes tyranny was the best way to run states because it's the only way to keep them secure. And that's the kind of straight reading of Machiavelli's Prince that, you know, you get a lot of people today still just taking at face value, because he does say some of the things you outline: better to be feared than loved, sometimes you have to enter into evil in order to secure your state, that sort of thing. But if the ironic reading is right, he's not saying these things because he thinks that, you know, all politics needs to go the way of princes, all politics need tyrants, but to sort of warn people that these are methods used by unscrupulous political leaders who claim to be protecting the interests of the state. They invoke necessity and security, but In fact, they're only interested in their own power.
Most people think that the 16th century Florentine writer, philosopher, and historian Machiavelli promoted a bare-knuckled, calculating, and ruthless style of politics. But people closer to his time didn't see him that way at all, and instead they saw Machiavelli as a champion of Republican ideals. Today we'll be in conversation about the life and times of Niccolo Machiavelli and what he may have meant with such books as The Prince. Our guest is Erica Benner. She is a Machiavellian scholar and author of the book Be Like the Fox, Machiavelli in His World. She joins us next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Donald Trump reportedly is backing away from his initial call to raise the age for all gun purchases to 21. CNN reported a congressional source said Trump has changed his position. The National Rifle Association is an opponent of raising the age for gun ownership. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said today the Trump administration will follow through on the president's order to ban the sale of bump stock devices.
The ability of this device that allows a semi-automatic rifle to fire on virtually an automatic system. So we've been working on that for some time. We'll have an announcement on that soon.
The Parkland, Florida shooter did not have a bump stock device. The Las Vegas shooter did. Senators meet today with some of the high school survivors of the Parkland massacre. Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin said their advocacy could mark a tipping point on gun safety legislation.
These high school students, 17, 18 years old, some even younger, have really become a national voice, a powerful voice, on the issue of gun safety in schools. I often wondered when this moment might occur or whether it would occur. It appears on this day, 13 days after the tragedy in Florida, that we are near or at a tipping point when it comes to gun safety.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. Conservative news aggregator Matt Drudge reports Donald Trump plans to announce his reelection bid this week, just 13 months into his first term. It wasn't immediately clear when or where Trump would make the announcement. Thousands of striking West Virginia school teachers are on the picket line for a fourth school day. They're demanding a face-to-face meeting with the governor and legislative leaders on their pay and other grievances. Teachers rallied outside the state capitol yesterday. Dale Lee is president of the West Virginia Education Association.
And we've made that clear. It's not only our health insurance, it's the pay, but it's also the respect and taking away the seniority, and those things have to go.
Teacher pay in West Virginia ranks among the lowest in the nation. The South African Parliament voted overwhelmingly to begin a process of expropriating land without compensation and returning it to the black majority from whom it was stolen. The vote was 241-83 in favor of the motion by the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, led by party leader Julius Malema, who was expelled from the African National Congress in 2012.
The time for reconciliation is over. Now is the time for justice. We do not seek revenge, though they caused so much evil in our land. We do not wish to for their suffering, though they caused so much humiliation of countless generations. All we want, all our people ever wanted, is their land to which their dignity is rooted and founded. Today, let us close this question once and for all. Let us unite and pay no one for benefiting from the crimes against humanity.
ANC members voted in favor of the motion. Whites still own a vast majority of privately held farmland in South Africa nearly 25 years after the country's first post-apartheid elections. Today's vote starts a process of constitutional reform leading eventually to land redistribution. A limited five-hour ceasefire in an embattled suburb of Damascus is over. Both sides accuse the other of violations. Yolanda Giacome, a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, she told Al Jazeera that along with evacuating hundreds of the wounded, humanitarian groups are calling for safety guarantees to deliver food, water, and medical help.
We need green lights for convoys to get in because we speak of a place of close to 400,000 people. Clearly, only a certain number can be evacuated. The others are in desperate need of medical assistance, of medicine, of food, and of clean water.
Russia ordered the humanitarian pause in eastern Ghouta, urging civilians to flee to safety. Many, though, fear they'll be killed or arrested if they leave. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. When we hear the word Machiavellian, we probably think of bare-knuckle politics. Rational, calculating, deceitful, manipulative, real, politique. And we probably think of phrases like it's better to be feared than loved. Politics have no relations to morals. And the word broken is a necessity of the present. Now, these sayings come from 15th century Florentine Niccolo Machiavelli. And many are from his most famous book called The Prince, which also many believe to be a handbook for despotic, tyrannical dictators. But Machiavelli wasn't a dictator. Instead, he was a philosopher, a historian, a writer, and even served as a diplomat in a short-lived republic. In fact, there is another entire train of thought about Machiavelli's philosophy of power politics, that it was meant to influence dictators to operate in such a way that would make those rulers despised and help lead to their downfall. Now that's some fascinating Machiavellian thought, and that's what we're going to be in conversation about today. Joining me on the telephone from Germany is Erica Benner. Now, Erica Benner has written a number of books about Machiavelli, including her latest. It's called Be Like the Fox, Machiavelli in His World. Erica Benner, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Did I get that right in understanding? Now, I have to say, when I first came into this, I was thinking of Machiavelli as bare-fisted politics, but I never thought of it in this other way. Did I summarize it correctly there, this other thought of Machiavelli's work?
Yeah, I mean, the other thought that you just said, that he actually wrote The Prince in hopes of kind of misleading princes into doing things that would lead to their own downfall, that's not my argument, but that was an argument of some people who read him early on. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of the book Cardinal Reginald Pole, who you know, read Machiavelli's Prince about 9 years after Machiavelli's death, and thought that, you know, this is the handbook of Satan, because, you know, this guy is pretending to give good advice to princes, but what he's really doing is giving you this kind of, you know, advice to lie, cheat, assassinate your way into power, that's naturally going to lead them to self-destruct instead of actually help princes. So that is one view. My view is different.
What is your view?
Well, my view is that he wasn't so much trying to be, you know, cunningly lead princes to kind of shoot themselves in their own feet. I think he was writing The Prince to kind of expose, as a satire, some people have said, or an ironic piece, which tries to expose the ways that a lot of, you know, aspiring monarchs use to kind of get their way into power by illicit means. And he exposes, a lot of the time when he seems to be saying, this is what princes do, we read it now and think he's saying, this is what princes should do, and this is how anyone, you know, should, who wants to get power, should try to do so. Maybe he was just actually exposing what they do so that people could be warned in advance and notice what powerful men are trying to do to get control over them.
Now,
that was an early reading. That's a very common early reading that's different from the one that you outlined, if you see what I mean.
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
But even your thought and your interpretation of The Prince is different than the way most people think of it today, at least in popular culture.
Yeah, I mean, most people do think of it as in the way that you said, that the book is a handbook for tyrants, basically, and that Machiavelli thought that sometimes tyranny was the best way to run states because it's the only way to keep them secure. And that's the kind of straight reading of Machiavelli's Prince that, you know, you get a lot of people today still just taking at face value, because he does say some of the things you outline: better to be feared than loved. Sometimes you have to enter into evil in order to secure your state, that sort of thing. But if the ironic reading is right, he's not saying these things because he thinks that, you know, all politics needs to go the way of princes, all politics need tyrants, but to sort of warn people that these are methods used by unscrupulous political leaders who claim to be protecting the interests of the state. They invoke necessity and security, as reasons for their unscrupulous actions. But in fact, they're only interested in their own power and not in the security of the whole. So that reading was made by many early readers of Machiavelli, who, most of whom were Republicans, people like Rousseau, people like Benedict Spinoza, Diderot, the encyclopedist in France, who is a colleague of Rousseau, and people like this thought that Machiavelli was trying to surreptitiously defend republics against the encroachments of princes, who were becoming more and more powerful in his day.
Well, I can't help but see the connection to Diderot there, who, again, as you indicated, wrote the first encyclopedia, because even Diderot's encyclopedia was considered to be subversive, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And Rousseau as well. And there's a whole school of English republicans, even before these French and Swiss and Dutch people we just talked about. The English school of republicans around the time of the English Civil War really latched onto Machiavelli as a fellow thinker, as somebody who did what they couldn't do very easily, namely criticize princes and monarchies in a kind of subtle way. I mean, they couldn't do it without very serious consequences themselves. They couldn't criticize the monarchy in England directly until the revolution actually broke out. Machiavelli, 100 years earlier, was subtly criticizing the whole kind of institution of monarchy and also the institution of the papacy, the kind of corrupt church, without kind of directly saying, look how bad they are, because that was a dangerous thing to do. He was, kind of sending all sorts of little jibes and describing in his little book what princes and popes over time have done to get power. And what he really shows in The Prince, if you really look at his examples, is, okay, a lot of these people got to power by lying, cheating, and assassinating, but once they got there, they found it really, really hard to hold on to power and became these kind of horrible despots who ruined their countries. And if you sort of read that longer message of The Prince, the more reflective one, then you get a whole different view of Machiavelli than the usual reputation he has.
And it made sense to me when you look at Machiavelli's biography and his life and the times and his family as well, which is all interesting. And so if Machiavelli was influential on the thinkers, the philosophers of the Enlightenment, Machiavelli himself comes from the Renaissance. Tell me what's important to understand about Machiavelli's world in which he lived in.
Machiavelli's Florence. I mean, he was a Florentine born and bred through and through. And the city of Florence at the time he was born was formerly a republic. It was a real rarity in Europe at the time, and indeed for most of history. It was a popular republic with a constitution that said, a very large portion of the male population are full citizens with rights to hold magistracies. That was the theory, but in practice, for about 80 years before Machiavelli springs into the political scene, One family, the Medici family of Florence, a big banking family, had used money and connections to make themselves basically princes. Princes, in fact, if not in name. And
First citizen, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. First citizen or princess. I mean, and that word comes from the Roman Empire, the old Roman Empire, where when the Republic was toppled in Rome, as you recall, the first emperors didn't call themselves emperors. They called themselves the first men, princeps. That was what it meant. And so people called these Medici, like them, first citizens, but they were supposed to be formally equal. In fact, they weren't. In fact, they were running the city for about 60 years, more and more, in a more and more tyrannical fashion. They got lots of people very upset, but they couldn't do anything about it. Right at the time of Machiavelli's birth, there was a real crunch time when the whole city of Florence was kind of, you know, hovering between a principality and a republic. Which way is it going to go? And when Machiavelli was in his 20s, the Medici were forced out, and they were sent into exile, and Florence was reestablished as a very popular republic, more popular than it had ever been, with more people involved in the city's public life. And that's when Machiavelli comes in as a diplomat and civil servant, and we first see him acting on the political scene as someone who is a big defender of this new popular republic. And one of the main things anyone who was working for this republic had to do was try to keep the Medici out, try to, you know, create and stabilize a constitution and a military system that was going to preserve this city in a kind of democratic form and keep any new tyrants or old tyrants from coming in and taking over again. So that's Machiavelli's, that's the context that I really tried to focus on in this book, to show, you know, how Machiavelli's life was so shaped by this real kind of turning point in Florence's life, or struggle. It was a kind of life and death struggle, really, between a constitution, a very ancient and proud constitution of republican freedom, and threats to that constitution from this family, the Medici, who are de facto princes, and others who are supporting them, especially moneyed interests and very old aristocrats who thought it was better to have a prince rather than a popular republic.
That's all interesting to me for a couple of reasons. First being that I always thought that a republic, and I know when you go from a Roman republic to a Roman empire, even during the time that today we consider the empire, they would still, you know, call it a republic, or you know, keep the institutions, even the term of first citizen, like we were talking about earlier, of giving the appearance of a republic. But I never realized there was this continuing struggle, even after this period, for a republic in Italy.
There was a big gap. In Florence, the Florence as a city only constituted itself as a republic in the, I think, 12th century, you know, in the 1100s. Before that, you know, Italy remained kind of a big, you know, it was just a sort of continent with all sorts of different states, most of them monarchies, or aristocratic states run by small family dynasties, you know, and Florence was one of those as well. Machiavelli actually wrote one of his fantastic books that's not very well known, is The Florentine Histories, Histories of Florence, which he wrote, one of his latest works, and he traces the origins of Florence out of the, you know, crumbling ruins of the Roman Empire, and all the different struggles that happened in Florence and before they created a republic. But then they created this republic in the 12th century, and it was unstable right from the beginning. There were always fights between the more aristocratic party and the people who wanted to make it more, you know, responsive to the plebeians, like in Rome. Working class, there was a big working class revolution, literally, in the I think the 13th century or 12th century, Chompi, the wool workers' rebellion, where the workers actually took over the city's government for quite a few months and ran things. And so it was a really turbulent history, but they had this republican tradition, which was a couple hundred years old by the time Machiavelli was born, and they were really proud of it. And the central tenet of it was the rule of law. I mean, they really, really valued the idea that this is a city not run by, let's say, the the poorest people or the majority of people, but by the laws. The laws are there to kind of make sure that every part of the city, people of all different backgrounds and interests, have a share of power. And having special obedience to the law is what allows them to kind of coexist. So that was the nature of the Florentine.
Yeah, and again, I just find that fascinating, because I guess when I think of the reemergence of an idea and a push for a republic, I think of the Enlightenment. I don't think of a few hundred years earlier.
Exactly, and that's something I find wonderful about the Renaissance. I mean, the Renaissance, of course, you know, it was called a Renaissance because it was a big rediscovery of all sorts of ancient Greek and, you know, Roman writings and literature that had some of it not been known well at all in the West, and some of it had, but a lot of people kept it alive
thanks to the Arabs, no?
Lot of it was kept alive thanks to the Arabs, and a lot of it was in Byzantium, you know, which had been Constantinople, where, you know, the Greek libraries and over there had kept a lot of stuff. And, you know, the ideas of republic and freedom and the rule of law you can find in Plato and Aristotle, Aristotle was known, but a lot of the political writings were not that well known, or they weren't understood well. All sorts of things had, and these ideas just kind of enjoyed this huge new life at this point. And people like, you know, literary figures, political philosophers, historians started using them and reviving them. Yeah, so this idea of the Republic as a glorious ideal, it was very much alive at the time of, you know, by the time Machiavelli was born. And he was one of the people who really kept it alive for later generations, as English republicans acknowledged, you know, in the 17th century, English republicans like Harrington and many others sort of explicitly said Machiavelli is the one who has saved the idea of rule of law and republic for us and passed it down to us. And then American founding fathers grew heavily on these English republican thinkers in turn. So Machiavelli's legacy is pretty deep and big.
He was a student of history, of ancient history. You've indicated this earlier, but I just think it's important. We recently on this program did a show about the fall of the Roman Republic, and we sort of outlined everything from Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus to Marius to Sulla to Julius Caesar, Caesar Augustus. He was very aware of this story. This was an important story for him.
Well, this is the story of his second most famous work, The Discourses on Livy. Because, as you know, The Prince is his most famous work, as you said. It's quite a short book. But his discourses are a big, long book. They take the form of a commentary on the Roman historian Livy, who wrote about the rise and then decline of the Roman Empire. And so Machiavelli talks all about all these figures, all the people you just mentioned, in great detail. And he gives you his comments on why, what lessons can people of his own time and people for the future learn about why well-ordered republics like the Roman one get sick, and what's the process that leads them to kind of self-destruct the way that Rome did. That's the question he poses throughout the discourses, in order that he can try to get his own contemporaries and future generations to build stronger and less vulnerable political orders.
We are in conversation with Erica Benner, author of the book Be Like the Fox, Machiavelli in His World. This is Letters and Politics, and I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I need just a quick moment of your time before we return to today's show to urge you to support this program and this radio station with a financial contribution. A contribution that is reasonable for you, one that you can afford, and one that you can feel good about at the end of the day, knowing that you did your part in ensuring that we can have elevated discussions in a world so dominated by crassness. Now, these are the shows that I do enjoy doing the most. Taking a common notion like that of Machiavelli, that promoted a ruthless style of politics, taking that notion and turning it on its head, and to do it in a way that matters for us today. Because we were able to make our $5,000 goal yesterday, I am able to continue to bring to air the type of programs that you tune in for, even during Fund Drive. If we make that goal today, then tomorrow we could do a show on the history of conservative thought, going all the way back to Edmund Burke and his opposition to the French Revolution. Could be said that modern politics began in France in 1789. So I am asking you for what I like to call a pure donation, getting to the heart of what this relationship of public broadcasting is really about. Now, we do have thank you gifts. The book we're talking about, The Letters on Politics, Ancient History Pack. Just ask the phone room volunteer when you call. But what I'm really asking you to do is to donate to support our work and make it possible for us to keep this going. $25 pledge will make you a basic member to your radio station. We're going to have to average about $100 per pledge in order to make our goal today. But that, as I've always said, is one person pledging $25, another person pledging $175, perhaps somebody who can afford a $500 or $1,000 contribution, and then they're making contributions for the good folks who cannot afford to make their own contribution today. So whatever you can afford, whatever you can feel good about. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. If you are listening to KPFA in Northern California, your donation will go to your radio station. If you're listening to KPFK down in Southern California, Los Angeles, well, that's where your donation will go as well. Your donation will go to your radio station. So that number again, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or pledge online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. We now return to the program. We are in conversation with Erica Benner, and we are talking about Machiavelli. She is the author of a number of books about Machiavelli, including her latest, Be Like the Fox, Machiavelli in His World. Another interesting thing, and you've touched upon this, but I just, you know, this is radio, so sometimes we want to really hammer on something, and that is the Medici. When we talk about the Renaissance, oftentimes the Medici are credited with at least bankrolling the Renaissance. Not as well remembered today, at least in my own mind. Maybe others remember this better than I do, but that they were actually, what dictators or tyrants?
Tyrants. Well, yes, I mean, that's right. They did, in fact, bankroll a lot of the wonderful kind of artistic things that you see if you go and visit Florence today. They bought loads and loads of art from all over Europe and bought lots of manuscripts from and scholars who were coming from the east, from Greek speaking parts of Turkey, what's now Turkey, and bringing them over to Italy to kind of, you know, make the Renaissance happen. And in those respects, we do have a lot of thanks to give them. But if you look at the historians of the time, people, Machiavelli, but also other historians, like Machiavelli's very good friend, Guicciardini, they were very, very sensitive to how the Medici were using their money, basically. They were a massively wealthy banking family with wonderful, amazing networks all over Europe. And they used this money and networks to basically make themselves into princes. And they did this at first without obviously breaking any laws. They just happened to have the money to get support when they needed it, to change things a little bit in their favor, or to get the people they wanted into the right committees and the right political bodies. But more and more, their behavior started to be seen as tyrannical because they got more and more, you know, managed to get more power in their own hands. They started to be able to eliminate their own rivals. And so by the time of the famous Lorenzo il Magnifico, the great Lorenzo de' Medici, who died shortly after Machiavelli was comes to the scene, by that time, people call him a tyrant quite openly because, you know, there was no other real power broker in Florence. But he was still officially just the first citizen.
And Machiavelli, he comes from a family that is pro-Republican.
Yes, because as far as we know, what we know about Machiavelli's family, we know mostly from his own histories, and he mentions a close cousin of his father who had been a big opponent of the first Medici figure to kind of try to get unseemly power. He'd ended up being sent into exile along with his brother and then died in prison.
Is that Girolamo? Girolamo.
That's Girolamo. Yes, yeah. That's right. Girolamo, who was a lawyer. He was a very highly thought of lawyer, and he'd been in politics himself, like every man, you know, man of that background in Florence. And he was one of the few who stood up to the Medici, and he got into big trouble for it. And that and Machiavelli's father had been very close to Girolamo. He was also a lawyer, and he's a strangely obscure figure. I mean, we have his diaries where he writes basically very daily business transactions, rather than anything personal or any opinions. And beyond that, we don't know much about him, except that he was a lawyer and highly respected in his community, but didn't practice law. He had all the qualifications. He had the Chancellor of Florence, who was a good friend of his, write a dialogue on the laws where Bernardo, Machiavelli's father, is the star of this dialogue on the laws. But we don't really know why didn't he practice law and why was he so poor. He could have, you know, surely he could have used his position to kind of do well by his family. And instead they were living very close to poverty, at least in very modest kind of circumstances. And it's likely that he, you know, was either uncomfortable working in a legal context that was dominated by the Medici, which he would have considered corrupt, or that they prevented him from working as fully as he might have done.
Did Niccolo Machiavelli, the person that we're actually talking about, the subject matter of our conversation right now, did he ever talk about the Medici?
Oh, yes. He talks quite a lot about them, but as he puts it in a more general way, he has a lovely quote from the Discourses where, without mentioning any names, he says, "One always speaks of princes with a thousand hesitations," which means that if you're going to talk about people like the Medici or anyone else who's got the same amount of power as they had when they had it, you've got to be really careful. So he doesn't mention the Medici by name, except in his dedication. He dedicated it to a young Medici prince in a very ambiguous introduction, saying, "I'm going to offer you the fruit of my knowledge and hope that you will make the best of it." But he doesn't mention them by name. In his Florentine histories and discourses, he does mention them quite a lot. And in the histories, he's subtly but openly critical, I would say, of the way that they came to power. He traces their rise to power very closely and discusses them all by name. And he wrote a letter to his friend Guicciardini, the historian I mentioned earlier, at the time that he was composing these histories. And he says, this is almost a verbatim quote, I think. He says, "I've just come to the part where I'm talking about how the Medici came to power, and I wish I were with you, my friend, so that you could advise me on what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say, because it's such a delicate matter. But I guess I'll have to just, take counsel with myself and find a diplomatic way to be critical." That's the essence of his, what he says. And I think that's what you read if you read his histories. He is diplomatically very ferociously critical of the way the Medici came to power.
And that's why you're comfortable looking behind or between the lines in what he writes with the prince?
Yeah, I mean, the story of the prince, of course, is that Machiavelli wrote it shortly after the republic that he'd served, this popular republic that came in after the Medici had been thrown out.
And how were they thrown out? Maybe that's an important point.
This republic lasted for basically 15 years, and Machiavelli was a very devoted civil servant working for the defenses of the republic. He was in a sort of defense job of a civil servant for defense. He worked for them for most of the time that the republic existed. Then the Medici came back in a coup that was backed backed by the Pope and Spanish troops. So it was a foreign-backed coup that brought them back into power. The Pope had lots of conflicts with the Republican government, mostly to do with foreign policy. And so the Medici came back, and Machiavelli was one of the very few people who was kicked out of his government jobs. The Medici were not, you know, they might be kind of tyrants, but not in the sense that we think about tyrant today. They weren't kind of, you know, Stalin. They were pragmatists, and they knew that Florence was a tiny city, and you had to work with who you had and who you had around. So unless there were some people you absolutely couldn't trust, you let them stay in their positions and you worked them. But Machiavelli was one of the rare people who was kicked out of his job, prevented from coming anywhere close to the government building where he'd worked for several years. And for many, many years after the Medici came back, he was out of a job. He was basically unemployed and had to make his living writing and from the family farm. So this is a sign that Machiavelli really did have the special problems with the Medici. Now, when he wrote The Prince, it was after he'd been imprisoned and tortured by the Medici under suspicion of being in a plot, and he'd gone off to the country and wrote, you know, had nothing to do but write. So he writes The Prince, tells his friends that he's done this book on princes and he would like to send it to the Medici. Now, this is all we know about what Machiavelli's intentions with The Prince were, that he has this one letter saying, I'd quite like the Medici to see this book. Now, we don't know if he did send it to them. I suspect not, because his friends were very cautious about it. We see from their letters saying that's not a good idea. But most people take from that, oh, well, he was writing this book on The Prince, which tells princes how to run the state and how to hold on to power. He was doing that trying to flatter them as a sort of job application. You know, he wanted to get back into the good graces of the Medici so he could go back into politics and have a job. And The Prince is a kind of serious attempt to say, look how much I know about politics. See how realistic I am. You know, how could you miss the chance to have a guy like me working for you? That's the straight view. Now, my view is, if you look at, I mean, the head of the Medici family that Machiavelli is writing to was Pope Leo X. He was a pope. Right. He was in the charge of Christendom. And the prince has a chapter talking about popes and how they assassinate and cheat and lie their way into power and how, you know, this, and it's a very satirical chapter about the papacy and the abuse of power that goes on in the church. He tells princes, if you read the prince literally, he's telling people, go ahead, don't you put aside your moral scruples about justice and, you know, and killing people. If you, you know, the main thing is you go and you keep power. If it means you got to kill people and lie and cheat, do it. Pope Alexander VII did it. Look at him. Why not? I'm not sure that this is the kind of gift that would have gone down really well with, you know, the Medici, especially when the head of the family was the Pope. So there's a lot of reasons to, you know, just historical reasons to doubt that the prince was meant as this kind of serious job application. And there are also reasons in the text itself. I mean, not only does it have these elements of broad satire, it's also got so many different bits of advice mixed in that contradict each other that sometimes you wonder, what's he really getting at? You know, one minute he'll seem to be telling you to go ahead and enter into evil if that's the only way to keep power. The next minute, he's telling you that if you don't observe justice, you're not going to keep power very long. How do you put those two things together? These are the kinds of things that got me thinking about whether the prince can really be as serious as we tend to think it is today.
Erica Benner is the author of the book, Be Like the Fox, Machiavelli in His World, a fascinating topic. And I'm going to argue worth really understanding to better know thyself, Though those are the words I would say on the top of the Oracle of Delphi in ancient Greece. Know thyself. ourselves. Speaking of Greece, a big thank you to Nostos Cafe, which is just across the street from us here at MLK in Berkeley. They're providing coffee and really good Greek pastries for our phone room volunteers. And we can use more phone room volunteers if you want to come down to KPFA and help us in our fund drive. Quick fundraising update, my friends, before we get back to this conversation. So far this hour, we have raised $800. Our goal is $5,000, and we have 20 minutes remaining in the hour. Again, what I am asking you for is what I like to call a donation, a pure donation. Support the work that we do here. $25 pledge makes you a basic member. We're going to have to average about a $100 pledge. It's everyone doing what they can according to their own means. There are thank you gifts. Talk to our phone room. Volunteer about them when you call in. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org and kpfk.org. Depending whatever radio station you're listening to, that's where your donation will go. Now, we are in this very important winter 2018 fund drive. And instead of offering thank you gifts, and again, we do have them, just talk to the phone room volunteer. I want to ask you to support this program today. Support it for the effort that our team here puts into this program to bring you something of value every day. Something to learn about. Something to think about. I am asking you to support that. To support something that is free to everyone, which is the beauty of radio. And yet you know that without voluntary acts of support, it will cease to exist. That's really what we're talking about here. And we are asking for a pure donation to go towards that, and a donation that is reasonable, one that you can afford, one that you'll feel good about. The phone number, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. We now return to our conversation with Erica Benner. Let's talk more about Niccolo Machiavelli's philosophy and his ideas that maybe they matter today. How did he see, plenty of evidence that he was a staunch Republican. How did he see republicanism? And he also warned about sort of the fault lines that could develop in republic or even democratic institutions.
Yeah, he has a very, probably one of the most interesting things he says about republics is that a good republic is not a unified state. So a lot of people think of good government and what is the best kind of government to have, and they think we want government that brings unity to all the different parts. We want harmony. And Machiavelli says this is a mistake, and if you start thinking that a state that shows divisions of any kind, and that is, you know, even quite kind of rambunctious divisions, if you start thinking that's dangerous, that's you know, that's panic, and think there's something really sick about this state, you're wrong. One of the things republics do, and what keeps them strong, is that they have different parties. People have different beliefs, different values. That's what free people are like. So if sometimes they have really vigorous arguments, even ones that might look kind of, you know, almost dangerously hot from the outside, don't worry about it too much, he says, because as long as you've got really strong laws and institutions that regulate these divisions and prevent them from turning into, you know, civil war, that's a sign of freedom, that you've got really big, you know, heated arguments going on. So he thought, you know, that what he called tumults in republics are really a good thing and a sign of freedom and good health. But he drew the line at what he starts calling discords. He said there's a point at which these party divisions or disagreements can become so bitter and so entrenched and hard that there's no compromise anymore, and that people start wanting to go over the walls to help their party win.
Well, is there a line? How do you know where that line is from? Okay, this is good, spirited, robust debate that's happening, to where it gets to a dangerous point.
Yeah, I think that's where his analysis of what happened in Rome gets into the nitty-gritty and shows you precise points where it started to be, where it started to the line started to get crossed. I I mean, in the general answer would be when the parties start wanting to break or change fundamental laws in order to give themselves an advantage. When the laws are no longer able to kind of stand as an impartial arbiter and a regulator of these divisions, but people start trying to change very basic laws so that they can get a permanent advantage over their party rivals, that's where you have to start worrying. And he says it's not a clear line. It's fuzzy, and it can take, you know, lots of tiny little steps that take you to the point where you suddenly say, hang on, now partisanship has gone so far that nobody values the common laws and the common standards anymore. Sometimes you don't realize that until it's too late. So the main message, as I read him, of his discourses is, you know, keep your eyes open all the time and study history to see how the different kinds of measures that have been used, you know, in the past for you know, party, leaders of parties who are trying to kind of get more than their share of power.
Yeah, the new precedents being set and tit for tat. And this is what he would have saw in the downfall of the Roman Republic, the ancient Roman Republic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when it's all tit for tat and no more, and even the idea that people look at some of the laws, the basic constitutional principles or institutions that had kind of served to, you know, as an umpire before between different party interests, and they no longer say, okay, this is an umpire we all trust, even if we're sort of grumpy when they call for the other guy. When they start saying, no, we don't believe them anymore, that umpire is, you know, it has been bought completely by the other side. So let's get rid of them. Let's set up a new kind of, you know, a new kind of government that doesn't depend on empire. When people start not trusting any sort of general standard to moderate their divisions anymore or to kind of arbitrate them, that's when you're in real trouble, I think he says. When everything they see, people look at politics and all they see is it's the other, you know, it's us against them and we've got to use whatever it takes to win. Then a republic is on its way to big trouble.
What happens when our institutions that are meant to mediate between differing interests in the public sphere fail to operate? Something we should always be quite conscious and about and thinking about. My friends, a quick fundraising update before we get to the end of our conversation today. We have now raised $950 towards that $5,000 challenge, and we have remaining 13 minutes. But I do want to tell you this. We do have three callers, three listeners, three fellow listeners, Stephanie in Berkeley, Lydia in Santa Cruz, and then somebody would like to remain anonymous in San Francisco, calling in, and have they together have put up $1,050 as a challenge. And what they're doing is they've heard us do these challenges in the past. They're using their resources. Again, it is about everyone doing what they can according to their own means. They're using their resources to see if they can help us raise even more money by encouraging you to donate right now. And if we can meet that $1,050 challenge by the top of the hour, well, that will be $2,100 for us. And that helps us get a long way towards our overall goal. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Now, I do think about our founder, Lou Hill, the founder of this radio station, the founder of this radio network, and he was concerned about, just before he founded this network, he was concerned about a lack of serious and intellectual discourse and exploration that you could find on the air. So he sought out to start a radio station that tries to do just that. And he thought that people would support it voluntarily because he knew commercial interest wouldn't and shouldn't, because all that would do is corrupt the process. We come up short frequently. Our ideals, what we are trying to do, our lofty ones, our high ones that we try to reach, we don't always make it, but that's the goal each and every time. 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org and kpfk.org. Back to the program.
That makes me think of one of his other sayings, perceptions matter more than reality.
Yeah, yeah. No, in The Prince, he said something about appearances matter more than reality. And that's a statement of how things look to ordinary, you know, to most people. Not necessarily to the, let's say, person who's most reflective, who's thinking most deeply about things. I mean, Machiavelli... It's debatable what kind of realist he is, but I think he certainly is some kind of a realist in the sense he's got a very realistic view of human nature and looks very deeply into things. Appearances matter to most people a lot, and whether or not, you let those appearances take over your sense of reality is a real question that he would grapple with in different ways. Yeah.
Machiavelli may not have been an egalitarian, but another threat, another fault that he would see in a Republican type of system is of excess of inequality.
Yes, I think Machiavelli is an egalitarian of sorts, and he's very kind of, he doesn't think, you know, he's not a communist, he doesn't think that all property ought to be distributed equally to everybody, but he certainly says very clearly that a republic that's based on very large inequalities in wealth and property is much less likely to be stable than a more evenly balanced one. I think the term evenly balanced is what he says. And he thinks that, you know, extremes of wealth and poverty are obviously going to be destabilizing. They were in Rome, and they became that way in Florence at various times. And it's a lesson that he takes from ancient authors and agrees with very strongly.
What? You've written a number of books, Erica Benner, about Machiavelli. What's your interest? What draws you to him?
How I came to Machiavelli is a boring and long story, but it was an accident, really. I wasn't at all interested in Machiavelli about 12 years ago. I had to teach bits of him now and then, like everybody who teaches political philosophy, but didn't really bother to read closely. And I just took for granted the usual views of Machiavelli. But at some point, for some completely different project, I started to read more carefully, thinking, okay, I just need to have a little small section on Machiavelli here to kind of make the rest of my argument about something else. And I started reading and suddenly realized, hang on, this is confusing. He's saying, the one minute he's telling us, go and be unscrupulous and don't care about justice. The next minute he's saying that justice is the basis of security, and anyone who behaves unjustly is going to bring hell down on their head. And, all kinds of little contradictions like this. There would be, like, different voices almost in his writings. And I kind of got hooked on just the puzzle of Machiavelli. I decided there was a puzzle that not everyone recognized. I noticed that people like Rousseau, in his Social Contract, said that he thought Machiavelli was writing The Prince as a satire, and that he was a philosopher of the Republic and of freedom. And I believed Rousseau more than I believed a lot of more contemporary readers, because Rousseau read a lot of the same ancient writings that Machiavelli did, and they had a lot of the same, like, sources and things they were thinking about. So I got hooked on my first interest wasn't really in the content of what Machiavelli said. It was kind of just wanting to know what's he saying? What are these different voices trying to, adding up to in the end? But having got into him, and I think started to trace a track of thought and realize that he was a consistent Republican in the way that I've said, I got really interested in the ideas themselves and started to kind of be persuaded by them. I never thought of myself as a sort of rule of law, Republican sympathizer before, but it now seems to me like a very reasonable sort of political theory, one that I see in lots of other ancient authors who I also have come to admire through Machiavelli with his help.
Erica Benner, this was fun and also really interesting, and I thank you greatly.
Oh, thank you. That was fun, indeed.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. You. Erica Benner has been our guest, and I hope we get to speak to her again, maybe about another topic on her next book. But her most recent book that we have been in conversation about is called Be Like the Fox, Machiavelli in His World. And I did enjoy that conversation a great deal with Erica Benner. And let me tell you, I did not, before at least preparing for that conversation about Machiavelli, know all that about Machiavelli. I had this common notion about Machiavelli too, this, you know, ruthless political philosophy. That's what I thought too. You know, I've always seen my role on this radio program as the student representative. I don't know most of this stuff going into it ahead of time, but what a great pleasure I get to do in talking with folks like Erica Benner and many others, and to be able to share that with you just means a great deal to me. So thank you. Thank you for being there. Whether if you can afford a contribution today or not, thank you for being there with us, and so that we could do this journey together. It's something that gives me great joy. I do want to give you an update on that $1,050 challenge by three people, three of our very fellow listeners who called it in. We have raised $245 towards that $1,050 challenge, and we have 4.5 minutes to make it. Stephanie in Berkeley, Lydia in Santa Cruz, an anonymous donor in San Francisco, pulled their resources together and saying, if we could raise that, that will be doubled. That will be $2,000 for us for this hour. And it really helps me to be able to bring you that show tomorrow about the history of modern conservative philosophy, to have a better grip of it, a better understanding of it, understand how it comes. The person we're going to talk to, Tim Robin, he argues it's actually reactionary oftentimes to what the left is doing. And it's really fascinating, including to think about what's going on today. But that is purely dependent on my ability to be able to make this challenge and to also be able to make our goal. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. As always, the radio station that you're listening to, that's where your donation is going to go to. So you will be supporting your radio station. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. So many people to thank so far this hour. Kristen in Berkeley, your continued support is always appreciated, and I thank you for living deliberately in the world today and supporting something to ensure that it's here for everyone. Same goes for Matthew, who is in Los Angeles listening to KPFK. Thank you for that, Matthew. And oh goodness, she did it again. Judith. Oh, Judith in Lambertville. You know, if back, we're talking about the Medici in the Renaissance period, and of course she had these rich patrons that supported the artist's work and philosopher's work. Well, if I had a patron today, it would be Judith in Lambertville. And Judith, thank you, as always. I also want to thank Candida, also listening from Pasadena on KPFK. Candida, very generous of you. And DB in San Francisco. DB, thank you. Mark in San Rafael, sir, incredibly generous of you. Thank you. And also James in Redwood City. James, thank you for getting the day off to a good start, at least for us.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Michael Parenti, Super Patriotism and the Importance of Being Number One. What does it mean to love one's country? Why is it important to be number one? In this sharp and funny speech, Michael Parenti dissects the uses of patriotism. That was the introduction to a Michael Parenti talk given in 1988 at the end of the Reagan administration. That talk became a TUC radio program and 2004 book published by City Lights. Super Patriotism, How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag Waving are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. Now, so many years later, slogans such as America First, America the Greatest Country on Earth, are having a powerful comeback. Resistance to super patriotism, even if it is simply remaining seated during the national anthem at a sports event, can draw a hateful response from those who Parenti was concerned about a generation ago. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale. He's the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into 18 languages. He grew up in an Italian-American working-class family in New York City. His PhD from Yale would have guaranteed him a career in academia. He knowingly gave up that chance when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam and was arrested. He decided to become an independent author, lecturer, and activist. Here's Michael Parenti in 1988 in Boulder, Colorado, recorded by KGNU Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a very special pleasure to be here in the Boulder political community. The title of the talk is Super Patriotism, Real Patriotism, and the Importance of Being Number One. Well, as a guest on radio talk shows, I have on a number of occasions criticized U.S. foreign policy, and one time an irate caller called in and he said to me, do you love your country? The question was obviously rhetorical. Here was someone who saw fit to question my patriotism because I was questioning the policies of our leaders. The caller was manifesting a symptom of what might be called super patriotism, also sometimes called stupor patriotism, also called pseudo patriotism, a phenomenon best defined as the willingness to follow our leaders uncritically in all their dealings with other nations, especially when those dealings are confrontational and belligerent and they involve a question of national pride or the use of military force. That's the definition of super patriotism. This super patriotism or American chauvinism has been with us throughout much of our history, and whether or not it's the last refuge of scoundrels, as Dr. Johnson would say, it certainly is a very effective instrument in discouraging and discrediting critical public discourse. Well, I think it's time that the super patriots account for their brand of patriotism and explain to us what it's all about. For instance, what do they mean when they say they love their country? What do they mean by country? You know, academia is not totally without certain virtues. You learn to ask a lot of trivial, detailed questions in any case. So I asked myself, what do you mean by country? Do they love every region and locale in the United States? Well, obviously, very few of us have been to every region and locale. Does love of country mean loving the American people? Well, again, even the most gregarious among us have met only a relatively small portion of the American people. And I would bet that these super patriots don't particularly love whole sectors of the American public, especially the more bigoted super patriots. In fact, rather dislike to associate with or have any positive identification with certain people because of reasons of ethnicity, religion, race, and class. Do super patriots love America for its history and culture? Again, I'm really skeptical of that because it's my impression that they know very little about American history and culture, or rather, much of it is rather unappreciated by them. Furthermore, there's a terrible side to our history that's really not all that lovable. For instance, the extermination of American Native Indian nations, the enslavement of African people, the aggressive wars against Vietnam, Mexico, Canada. We lost 1,000 men on one attack on Canada. I just learned a little while ago. Central America, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Nor might we all be that enamored with certain aspects of American culture, certainly not the mind abuse of primetime television, the commercialism, the corporate greed, the ecological devastation, the economic and racial injustice. If I'm being asked to prove my patriotism by loving American popular culture, then I might fail the test, I guess. Well, the America that the super patriots claim to love is neither a geographical totality, nor is it a vast population, nor is it really a history or culture. As far as I can see, their America, when they say love America, is an ideological abstraction. It's an emotive symbol that can be embodied in other abstract symbols like the flag. It's a sort of almost a love without content. I mean, how else can you love a flag? I mean, a flag, as you know, is a piece of rag on a stick, and it's got colors and things. Well, having said that, let me contradict myself, because there is one real content to the super patriotism. Its main substance is militarism. The pacifist and political scientist and activist, by the way, good pacifists are all, not passive, they're pacifists, and they're quite active. The pacifist and activist, Milford Sibley, he once noted, quote, "Patriotism for most professional patriots seems to be inseparably connected with military violence and war." Indeed, the most militaristic among us seem to think that they are the most patriotic. Isn't that rather extraordinary? Patriotic virtues are equated with military ones. Our history's patriotic vignettes are usually military ones. Valley Forge, the Alamo, Gettysburg, the battleship Maine, Pearl Harbor, raising the flag on Iwo Jima, D-Day, the MIAs and POWs, and the like. Our country, right or wrong, but mostly our country at war or ready for war. The commemorations of our national leaders during national holidays would be incomplete without the marching troops, the weapon displays, martial music, formations of fighter planes zooming overhead. Even in local communities, when they organize patriotic celebrations, they usually appear the marching bands in semi-martial uniforms, the high school cadets with rifles on their shoulders, and if there's an army base nearby, even troops. I remember once sitting in Urbana, Illinois, standing there July 4th, watching this parade come by, and on this float was suddenly this missile, sort of small missile. But there was this instrument of death on this float that was going by. And there were some people around me, and you know what they did? They started to applaud this inanimate object. I mean, there wasn't even a pilot or, you know, somebody else tending to it, or a soldier striding it and waving and going, "Yow, look at me," you know. I mean, it was too much for me. They were just applauding this weapon. And then a little jet fighter came by on the float, and they started applauding that too. This was at a time when these things were being used in Vietnam. Even July 4th fireworks are really a benign representation or replication of the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, as the top patriotic song on our patriotic hit parade goes. Max Weber once said that the state's irreducible characteristic is a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. And to be sure, state ceremonies in most states include some display of military force. Now, the way super patriots express their national pride leaves me uncomfortable. It seems the love we are to have for our country rests on some kind of competition with other countries, that it comes at an expense with other countries. It's a love that is predicated on some invidious comparison to other countries being lesser, being not as good. If we love our country, we have to believe it's better than any other. The super patriots will even ask us, "Don't you think this is the best country in the world?" So that you love it because it's better. This, by the way, we might recognize immediately as the being number one syndrome. I guess I must have heard about being number one for a long time, but the first time it ever stuck in my mind was when I heard President Richard Nixon sometime in the late 60s announce, and I quote, America is still number one. And the still, of course, you know, hints at some anxiety that there might be some slippage there. So I'm listening to this and I'm saying, okay, number one, that's, hey. But I was bothered by it because it presumed that we were in some kind of adversarial relationship to other nations, all other countries, and that somehow our greatness and our goodness could only be measured in comparison to them, only in our ability to be the top banana. And then one of those troublesome questions came again in my head, and I said, if we're number one, what are we number one in? I mean, what are you number one in? So I thought, I said, population? And then, no, the Chinese walk away with all the awards in that category. Geography? No, I think the Soviets and even Canada has more real estate than we do. We're not number one in size. I mean, Brazil is a number of countries, I think. I don't even want to think about it, about all the countries that might be ahead of us there. Steel production and other basic industries? I perked up a little. Well, we used to be number one in that, but we have slipped down the list because our super patriot corporate leaders have taken to abandoning our communities and exporting our jobs and bringing the factories off to Taiwan and Argentina and South Korea, where they can work for slave labor wages. Which, when you think about it, is not the way for super patriots to act, really, you know, take our factories away and all that.
I'm interrupting Michael Parenti for a moment to remind you that this contemporary-sounding talk was given in 1988. It became a TUC radio program and a book. Super Patriotism, How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag-Waving are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale.
I was sitting there saying, well, what are we number one in, you know? And the best I can tell from the super patriotic utterances is that it gets down to two things. One, wealth, with no concern as to how the wealth is distributed and how it's used and for what effects. And military power, with no concern, again, with how that military power is used and for whose interests that it might serve at home and abroad. Now, supposedly, we can love America and be proud of our country because it's so great. The implication is, however, that if it weren't so great, it wouldn't be so lovable. And that began to trouble me. The super patriot's love of country seems predicated on the country's being up there, stronger and superior to other countries. What happens if it's going to slip? What happens? I started thinking, what about people from lesser lands, as we might call them? I mean, what about somebody from Luxembourg? I mean, now Luxembourg is number 122, you know. I said, what does someone from Luxembourg do? Do they go around shamefaced like this, you know? And you say, you from Luxembourg? You from Luxembourg? I said, No, I'm French. And you say, do you love your country? You know, they say, well, what is there to love? I mean, a few border police, no army, no navy. I mean, it's a... The super patriots were exhilarated by the U.S. aggression perpetrated against Grenada. To them, such military exploits are an affirmation of our nation's strength and worth, and therefore their own individual strength and worth. I mean, there are some people who went around who really got off on the invasion of Grenada. Ronald Reagan, the conqueror of Grenada, reflecting upon his greatest military victory, hailed the venture as an example of how the U.S. defends democracy. This preoccupation with being number one strikes me, ladies and gentlemen, as I say, as a sign of weakness, not of strength, as a sign of insecurity, not of security. A people who know who they are don't worry about being number one. A people who are in touch with the deeper values of social justice and democracy don't get a number one thrill from stomping on a tiny nation. A people who seek friendship and cooperation with other peoples don't need to lord it over other nations and outshine them. Such a people don't have to find reassurances in themselves by looking at or imagining the deficiencies of others. And they don't feel threatened by the accomplishments and strengths of other people. The state is no longer there to serve us. We are here to serve and glorify the state. The state becomes an entity, a force unto itself, a powerfully abstracted symbol that claims our ultimate and total loyalty, a moral object, a moral entity in itself, whose existence and growth are taken as self-justifying. You know, a question could be raised. What's so important about the state existing and growing and continuing and expanding and flourishing, whatever else? That's taken as self-justifying. In fact, that question would be considered unpatriotic. The moral code that applies to nationalism does not operate the same as the moral code that applies to individuals. The premises that governs all individual morality is that your behavior must at some point lead to self-restraint and even self-sacrifice. In individual morality, there are certain things you should not do, even if they're convenient, advantageous, and whatever else. Even if you have the impulse for them, even if they advance your self-interest, you must not do them. That's what the whole essence or code of individual morality is, as in thou shalt not. These premises are inverted when applied to a nation's behavior, and they often lead to terrible and untrammeled excesses. The nation state is something more than human, and there lies the power of its appeal. At the heart of the superpatriotic ethic is the belief that the nation's existence and its actions are so endowed with virtue as to place it above the commonplace rules of life. The restraints that apply to ordinary humans don't restrain the nation. So, convinced of its supreme virtue, the nation knows no other restraint than the limitations of its own self-interest, its own desires, and the limitations of its own power. Ladies and gentlemen, the difference between individual morality and national morality is a very real one. When the aggrandizing individual commits an evil or harmful act, there's some sense that he is to be punished, he or she, or should be punished. At least some questions raised about whether proper standards of conduct haven't been violated. But some of the most outrageous acts, which would be outrageous under an individual moral code and unsupportable in civil life, are applauded as heroism when performed in the name of the nation. Thou shalt not becomes thou shalt do anything by any means necessary if it can be said to be in the national interest and if it serves national security. Well, who are the super patriots? They can be found in high and low places. They can be found in the White House, and they can be found in your local American Legion post. But super patriotism, I would argue, is not a product of mass psychology. It's not a product of mass macho psychology as such, although it certainly appeals to machismo, often resorting to a kind of John Wayne approach to foreign policy. The suppliers, the pushers of super patriotism, most conspicuously are our top political leaders, our publicists, our media pundits, our institutional heads, including some college presidents and corporation leaders. Super patriotic ideology is assiduously propagated by the ruling class of this society. But ideas do not float around in social space. You see, there's no such thing as just an idea around, like a virus. And so with ideas are mediated through social structure, through social organization, through a social system, that is through organized statuses, roles, groups, families, schools, communities, media, other institutions, whatever else. And some ideas then are mass marketed. Some ideas are taught to us from day one in those little flag salutes we have at school. One of the key functions of super patriotism is to blur the differences in class interests in our society and try to convince us that we're all in the same boat, rich and poor alike. You, me, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers. In truth, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, on almost every issue, we the people are not in the same boat with the big financiers and companies. The costs of our policies are not equally shared. We pay the brunt of the costs. The benefits of our policies are not equally enjoyed. We don't get much of that. There's a case where you have to have a class analysis rather than a flag-waving analysis. This is equally true of ancient empires as well as modern empires. In 1919, the conservative economist Joseph Schumpeter, he described the imperialism of classical Rome. in words that might sound familiar to present-day Americans. Quote, "That policy which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism." He's writing in 1919 about ancient Rome. "There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why, then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall upon the Roman people." Now, in contrast to the super patriots, it begins to brighten here. Real patriots love their country enough to want to improve it, and their patriotism has a social content, and that social content is social justice. Real patriots do things the American way, the democratic way, not with secret crypto-fascist coteries in the national security state, but with open debate and open challenges against privileged interests. Real patriots know that democracy is not just the ability to hold elections, but to serve and fulfill the basic needs and interests of the demos, the people. Real patriots are also internationalists. They may love and feel attached to their country, but they also love the peoples of all countries, all being different representations of the human family. Real patriots find different things in our history to be proud of than the super patriots do. We're proud of things like the struggle for the enfranchisement, the abolitionist movement, the peace movement, the abolition of child labor, the struggle for collective bargaining, the extension of universal suffrage to people of color and to women, the struggle for racial justice, the eight-hour day, occupational safety, the struggle for gender equality. We need change. We need to tax the rich and not the poor. We need to restructure the use of energy to save the environment and ourselves. We need a health insurance program for the 35 million Americans who are not covered. I mean, isn't that amazing? Isn't it time for an investigation? How could that be? How did that come about? Why? We need people who not only bemoan these things, like the liberals say, isn't it a shame, the homeless? Isn't it a shame, not enough adequate health care? Isn't it a shame? You have to stop complaining about that. You have to start asking, but why does that exist? What are the forces that allow, in the richest country in the world, these kinds of terrible inhumanities and inequalities? The airwaves of this country, ladies and gentlemen, are the property of the people of the United States. That may come as a surprise to some network bosses, but it's true. And those airwaves should be opened up. There should be public access television. We need exposure to a socialist perspective. We need exposure to various dissident perspectives in the mainstream media. And we need discussion of worker-controlled enterprises and public ownership. We need a national debate in the mainstream media on the oppressive, unjust purposes of U.S. foreign policy in the Third World and elsewhere. We need to re-examine our institutions, our schools, our colleges, hospitals, museums. We've got to find out why all those institutions, our media, why they are all dominated by self-selected boards of trustees or regents who are answerable to no one but themselves and who control all spending, all hiring, and all other policies. We need a government that has the capacity to go directly into not-for-profit production. If private industry can't provide the needs of the people, if the utilities can't give you electricity without jacking up the rates every year, jacking it up again and again, then take it away from the utilities and the people themselves can do it themselves. If private industry can't build us homes and hospitals and get jobs, then let the public sector do it. There's all these people who need work. There's all this work that needs to be done. There's all this capital that can be used to do it, and none of it's come together because there's no profits in it for the Morgans and the Rockefellers and the DuPonts. So then let the public sector do it, not for profit, and it will get done. And when it gets done, it creates social income, it creates private income, it expands your tax base, it creates public income, and it creates more opportunities for growth. The danger with that, the danger is not that it won't work, the danger is that it does work. And that's why they stop it, that's why they want privatization, that's why they sell off Conrail at one-third its actual value, because Conrail under public ownership was working, and those railroads under private ownership were milked like cows. milked and run down, and then they turn around to the government, they turn around to the taxpayer, and then they go socialist after they've milked it down and it's about to fall apart, and they say, we can't run it anymore. You're going to have to take it over. And the taxpayers take it over, and they dig deeper into their pockets, and they pay for it, and they put it back on a working basis, a rational basis, a not-for-profit basis, so that the money it makes goes back into it and doesn't go out to the George Bushes and the Ronald Reagans and their class. And then when it works, Ronald Reagan says, we got to sell this thing. And he sells it not because it wasn't working, but because it does work. We need to open up our political system, ladies and gentlemen. We need to have new parties, not just two capitalist parties, not just two anti-communist parties. We need to have proportional representation so that if a minority party wins 11% of the vote, it gets 11% of the seats. We need funding for minority parties. We need free TV time for minority parties. We on the left are second to no one in our patriotism. We want fundamental restructuring and democratization of overseas and domestic policies. We want restructuring and democratization of the political process, the values, institutions, the economy, and the class power of this country. We real patriots say, along with Albert Camus, I want to love my country and justice too. And in fact, I believe that the only way you can be a real patriot is to love justice. Because you can't be patriotic to something that's unjust. We want to spend less time trying to save the world with bombers and battleships and more time healing ourselves. This is not just a good idea or a noble pronouncement. It is a historical necessity. This country does not belong to Ronald Reagan and his billionaire friends, although they act like it does. It belongs to us, and sooner or later, we will take it back. Thank you.
You heard excerpts from a talk on superpatriotism by the internationally known writer and lecturer Michael Parenti. He is one of this country's foremost political analysts and the author of over 20 books. This timeless archival talk was recorded by KGNU Radio. And the presidency of Donald Trump brought back the memory of this 1988 TUC radio program and of the book published by City Lights in 2004, Michael Parenti, Super Patriotism: How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag Waving are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. If this sounds important today, please pass on this free speech. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The sting of separation and the wearing of an uncomfortable truth is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Our discussion is about the 2.7 million children of prison inmates in the United States who are losing the right to visit their parents. Sylvia A. Harvey, an investigative journalist, is our guest. Her story about the diminishing opportunities for children to visit their incarcerated parents was the December 14th cover story for The Nation magazine. Some of Harvey's most cherished childhood memories are the times when she was able to visit her father while he was an inmate at Soledad State Prison in California when she was between the ages of 5 and 16. When Sylvia Harvey and I visited by phone from her home in New York City on January 18, 2016, we began with her personal experience and how now not being able to visit a parent in prison affects 2.7 million children.
One of my memories from an extended family visit when I was a kid was very reminiscent of being home. Right? So when I was home, my father would cook. That was like his big thing. He loved to make home fries, like country fried potatoes and things that were some really big favorites of my brothers and I. So just sort of being in a room on the prison grounds at this family visit, but still feeling and smelling the memories of home was profound. So it was something that was really important, being able to connect with my dad, to connect with my brothers, and be a family, you know, for 3 days. So it was an amazing experience, and it's something that I just recognize is now being taken away from children today.
And being a family for 3 days, that in and of itself is a comment, I believe, on early childhood education, on what we learn prior to the time our memory goes back to maybe the age of 6 or 7. What stands out in your article to me is 1 in 9 black children have a parent in prison. 1 in 57 white children has a parent in prison. And the broader effect that that has on society in the United States now.
Yeah, I think that that's a huge issue, right? We're thinking about how black and brown people are disproportionately incarcerated. And it shows, if we're looking at the number of black children that are being affected by having a parent incarcerated, it just leads back to mass incarceration. So it's not just, oh, it happens to be that these children have more parents in prison. And so we have to look at the system. We have to think about what's happening from a systemic perspective, what's happening in terms of the sentencing, what's happening in terms of policing in our communities. All this stuff is just sort of goes back. So if we look at 1 in 9 children, it goes back to the idea that black and brown people are being incarcerated at rates that are just astronomical. That's a huge issue.
So let's look at that system and that huge issue and what's behind it.
Well, I think it's hard to just pinpoint, right? I think that we know some of the issues if we're looking at a community of color and we're looking at a community that's over-policed, right? We're looking at the tough-on-crime idea of incarcerating people for drug offenses, right? So we're looking at the 3 strikes law, different things that are affecting communities of color at a higher rate and what that says and what that does, you know, for the overall correctional system.
Some of those families have a voice. In your article, you talk about children proud to tell their story.
It was almost a matter of coming out. It's something very private, and I think that people consider it to be private because of the way that it's perceived by society. And coming forward in this story was recognizing that this is a really big issue. It's an issue that's affecting families all across the country. And the more public you are about that issue, the more likely it is that other people will be comfortable in recognizing what's happening to the family and also to see how policy can be affected to make change. If we're learning more about stories, more about families, more about the direct effect of losing these kinds of programs, the more likely it is that people are willing to tell their story.
Affecting policy to make change, what would be the appropriate changes that you consider?
Well, I would say first we have to continue to have programs that we know reduce recidivism, that we know continue to maintain family bonds. And I think that this program, the Extended Family Visiting Program, is one of those such programs. In New Mexico, this program was ended just last year, and it was supposedly ended because it saved $120,000 per year. And that's of a budget that's $293 million. So I think that if we look at something like that and recognize that the families had to pay a fee, and so they offset that cost by $40,000. But this is a program that was removed, but this is a program that we know is maintaining family bonds. We know that it's giving children access to their parent that's incarcerated. And we also know that visiting has continuously proven to reduce recidivism. So starting with programs like this and not cutting those programs, like saying these people need to have contact and this is going to be helpful when they are released from prison. So I think that policy starts in small steps, like not cutting these kinds of programs and then rethinking how we do visiting. So if children are going to visit their parents in prison, what do those visits look like? What is the process to get inside the prison? Those are things that we have to think about from a perspective that recognizes family, that recognizes that the incarcerated are also human.
Sylvia, what do you see are the reasons why the prison authorities are increasingly terminating and disallowing the extended family visits and conjugal visits?
Well, in the case of Mississippi, Christopher Epps, the former corrections commissioner, cited budgetary reasons associated with the visits as one of the reasons they were cut. But when I submitted a request to see the numbers under a Freedom of Information Law request, the savings were never disclosed. And I reasoned that if there were significant savings, then the Mississippi Department of Corrections would have been happy to disclose the numbers. But the bigger issue and more problematic reason he listed was that even though contraception was provided, he was unclear on the number of children that were being born from these visits. And I think that leads back to the same fears of sexuality that produced these programs in the beginning.
And those fears are?
So the fear is that we have this population of people that are going to mass produce children, and these children are going to be sent into single family homes where they're going to perish. It's just unfortunate and problematic that one of the reasons is the number of children that could be produced from said visits.
What is the history of conjugal and later family visits in prisons in the United States?
So conjugal visits started in 1918 at Parchman, and they were born out of a derogatory racial stereotype. It was the idea that black men had uncontrollable libidos, and they needed to have some form of relief. So the idea was, let's let them have access to sex so they can work harder in the prison penal farming industry. And it wasn't until 1930 that white men were allowed these conjugal visits as well. And then in 1972, women were allowed these visits. And then in 1974, they launched the Family Visitation Program, which was 3 to 5 days, and it was open to parents, siblings, and children, in addition to spouses. So they started to shift the focus to rehabilitation and strengthening the family ties. In 1968, through the 1980s, we saw a number of states join the ranks.
And in the 1990s, it began to reverse and become limited. Can you tell us about that change?
Yeah, the 1990s seemed to mark a more punitive approach that took hold in corrections. In 1994, we see that President Bill Clinton signed the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. And that was an act that implemented mandatory minimum sentences enhancements. It widened the use of death penalty, limited amenities for prisoners, including higher education, and it just continued after that. So the following year, we see the No Frills Prison Act, and that eliminated, in quotes, frills, anything that was deemed to be an unnecessary thing for prisoners, the weightlifting equipment or unmonitored phone calls or clothing or hot plates to cook. And in 1996, Congress awarded grants to states that made prisoners serve as much of their sentence time as possible. So we just saw a consistent new approach to corrections that was less about rehabilitation and significantly more punitive in thinking. And from there, we just saw year after year some of these programs just ending.
The next step from an economic or from a governmental perspective may be to end extended family visits. What do you see as the consequences of that?
Ending the extended family visit is a detriment to the family bond. You can have the short visits, but if we think about the fact that children have to travel on average 100 miles to see their parents, and we're thinking about the costs that are associated with that, the gas or the transportation or the food, anything that's associated with that for such a small amount of time and such limited physical contact, that if you actually have an extended visit, the costs related to that travel, to that visit, seem significantly more justified. And the bigger issue is that if we're taking away these extended family visits, it could lead to removing even more programs and visitation, which we see consistently happening in the jails. Currently, 74% of jails that implemented the new video visiting later banned in-person visits. So we're looking at jails that are adding video visitation at the expense of removing in-person visitation.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Sylvia A. Harvey, a researcher and a writer whose December 2015 article about the effects on children whose parents are in prison was published in The Nation magazine, entitled 2.7 Million Kids Have Parents in Prison. They're Losing Their Rights to Visit. Sylvia Harvey, can you please talk about the effect of family visits on recidivism and parole violations?
Yeah, I think we've seen time and time again that visitation is linked to the reduction of recidivism. Some of the most recent is the Minnesota Department of Corrections in-depth study where they tracked over 16,000 offenders released from state prisons. And when other factors were controlled, the study showed that prisoners who received visits were 13% less likely to be convicted of a felony after release and 25% less likely to have their probation or parole revoked. And Florida Correctional Facility did a similar study where they saw that the more visits you had, the less likely it was for you to recidivate. And I think that just time and time again, we see that the Urban Institute did a study returning home, understanding the challenges of prisoner reentry, and explored the pathways of prisoner reintegration, and saw that these prisoners successfully reintegrated. They stayed off drugs. They found jobs the more they were connected to their family prior to being released. So it's something we see that is evidence-based.
You talk about that as well in relationship for extended visits to be the most helpful developmentally for children in terms of children seeing their parents as real and as humans. Can you talk about that perhaps in two factors, your personal experience and the information that you gathered in preparing your paper?
Anne Adelis Estrin, who directs the National Resource Center on Children and Families of the Incarcerated at Rutgers University, which I've quoted in my piece, talks about the idea of regular visits compared to extended family visits. And we know that if, like she says, in a regular visit, they're in very uncomfortable visiting arrangements. There's hard seats. There's limited face-to-face time. You can't touch each other. It limits the child's ability to go through cadence. And her reference to cadence is it's a series of group developmental stages therapists look at as form, storm, norm, and perform. It's the idea that you have enough time to go through a sequence of emotions and feelings. You get to recognize your parent fully. So if you have 3 days, the likelihood of you having the opportunity to be upset with your parent arises, and you get to be upset, and you get to recover from that. And if you only have 2 hours to visit, the likelihood of you bringing up something that is difficult for you is unlikely. And I'd say for me personally, there were times where I was upset about my father's incarceration, and if you have 3 days, we get to talk about that. You know, my father was able to say, this is what happened, and this is why I am here.
Sylvia Harvey, what has your investigation shown about the effects on children of visiting their incarcerated parents?
I think that one of the big issues is that we don't have very much information about these children, right? We do know that it's a large number. We know it's 2.7 million children that have been affected, but we don't know in what ways. And I think that that is where we need to ask for government action. That's where we need to say, how is this something that's being done from a federal perspective? And we see that starting to happen. In 2012, the White House created a federal interagency working group called the Children of Incarcerated Parents. And what that does is evaluate the federal programs and policies that impact these children. So we're looking at research and running public education initiatives. But I think that federally funded programs that aid these children is what is very hard to find, and that's what we need more of. I think that we can look at the Department of Justice and see that they've awarded $53 million in grants to reduce recidivism in 2015, but only three of those grants, which totaled to a little more than $1.2 million, were committed to programs dealing explicitly with children of incarcerated parents. So I think that we need to allocate time, resources, and finances to figuring out how incarceration is directly affecting this group. How is it affecting children?
Sylvia Harvey, I'd like you to share with us what the Muppets have done, what the Sesame Street workshop has done on this issue.
I think Sesame Street has really broke some amazing ground. The initiative is called Little Children, Big Challenges. It's a number of free multimedia resources for families that have young children that are affected by a parent's imprisonment. And what you see is Alex. So Alex is blue-haired, green-nosed Muppet that has his father incarcerated. And it just plays out a scene where Alex is talking to the other Muppets and they're talking about getting their dads to make toy cars for them. And you see that Alex is having a very difficult time because he can't have his father help him make these toys. And then we see Alex finally say that his parent is incarcerated and that's why he's not present to help, and how that makes him feel and how he has this level of shame. So I think that Sesame Street is really tackling something important, and that's the idea of shame, and that's the idea of access and communication. So we get to have a Muppet that a lot of children can relate to. And I think that that's important. That's something that hasn't been done. I think that it also says that this is a huge problem if we see that Sesame Street's Sesame Workshop has decided that there is a need for a child or a Muppet to have a parent incarcerated, to show what that does to society and to children.
Going back to your personal experience, the visits that you had with your father ended in 1997, at the end of your privacy with your father. How old were you at that time?
The extended family visits ended for specific demographics of prisoners, and my father happened to be one of those. I believe I was 16 at the time, and things changed, right? So the idea was you no longer have this private access to your parent, so you figure out other ways to maintain your bond, and that really consisted of going up for regular visits. It consisted of, when I turned 18, making a pact to going every Saturday if I could. And that just sort of continued with letters and phone calls and sort of, yeah, it just continued after that. But after the visits were taken away, it was obviously a huge blow. But what do you do?
Maybe you could share with us what you have done. Obviously, you have written extensively about it, researched extensively about it, and you mentioned earlier policy changes.
Yeah, I think that it's important to recognize what has happened from a personal perspective and what is currently happening to children across the country. And I think that talking about it, writing about it, bringing attention to the matter is the first step. So for the number of people that had no idea that there were these types of visits, now they have an understanding of the kind of access that children did have to their incarcerated parents. And it's something that we can think about and saying, what was this like what has it done, and also look at other states like New York and California and Washington that continue to have these visits and continue to say what these visits do for the demographic that it serves.
Well, Sylvia Harvey, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you share with us an aha or eureka moment that has affected your life or changed your approach to your world?
I would say it was probably during a meeting years ago in Oakland at a meeting at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. And it was me and a group of other young activists. And we're having a meeting about the Rioters. The Rioters were a group of police officers that were planting drugs on young men in the community and framing them. And we continuously tried to have our voices heard. We would call different newspapers or different television stations to tell them what we knew was happening. And nothing was done. And it wasn't until a number of months later that it appeared in newspapers after one of the rookie police officers came forward. And it was in that moment that I thought, how do I take up space where I can be a voice for people that don't have access to telling their stories? And that's when I thought about journalism. Like, I've always thought I'd be a lawyer, which is still possible. But in that moment, I thought I could take up this on my own. I could be a voice, and I could be in a space where I don't have to depend on anyone else. I can tell the stories of the people. And that's what I'm doing.
And what would you like to do? Maybe you just answered this, but what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Wow, it's such a huge, I guess, question. I think I want to be present, right? And when I say present, I mean be present and aware and conscious and continuously respond, right? When I see something I consider to be an injustice, when I see something I think needs to be covered, is to do my part in covering what needs to be covered, to do my part in telling the stories that need to be told, to do my part in moving our society forward in a just way.
And finally, Sylvia Harvey, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Oh, wow. There's so many books that I can recommend. Let's see. But you know what I would do? I would actually recommend something that's a bit quicker and easier. And it's a song. It's Nina Simone's Ain't Got No. And I think it's just such a powerful song to think about and figure out, what do I want to do? What am I doing here? Where do I want to go? And it only takes 3 minutes. So I'd recommend a song.
Well, Sylvia Harvey, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me.
Sylvia Harvey is an independent freelance journalist based in New York City. Her article discussing 2.7 million children losing the rights to visit an incarcerated parent in prison was published in The Nation magazine on December 14, 2015. Instead of recommending a book, Sylvia Harvey recommends the song Ain't Got No by Nina Simone. This program was recorded on January 18, 2016.
Ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweater, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no bed, ain't got no mind, ain't got no mother, ain't got no culture, ain't got no friends, ain't got no schooling. Ain't got no love, ain't got no name, ain't got no ticket, ain't got no token, ain't got no God. And what have I got? Why am I alive anyway? Yeah, what have I got? Nobody can take away. Got my hair, got my head, got my brains, got my ears, got my
That should be good.
That's groovy.
Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. Christina Onnestad and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.